From Babylon Don.
Hey, what's going on, Don?
Okay, sweetheart. Also, we're officially in the building now. I need a mic check from Nefertiti Surviving the Game. My manager.
Mic check.
Good job. Need a manager, key turn. And the one and only Fire Lioness finally got her on. And I do want to thank everybody for staying up with us through Hot Damn Politics. It really means a lot. I just want to tell you that. All the call lines, the callers on the call lines and people that's logging on, it means that, yes, you like this shit as much as I do. All right, mic check, Fire Lioness. Can I get it? Fire Lioness. Fire.
Talking, I'm on mute.
All right, we got you, baby. Woo!
Okay, Don, we are still on page 261.
I'm in the middle of the paragraph, y'all. This says after the middle of the present century, if I think. Am I right?
That's right.
Okay. All right, shall we begin? Is the water warm enough?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's dive in.
After the middle of the present century, the first danger had in reality disappeared. Each of the three powers which divided the world is in fact unconquerable and could only become conquerable through Each of the three powers which now divide the world is in fact unconquerable and could only become conquerable through slow demographic changes which a government with wide powers can easily avert. The second danger also is only a theoretical one. The masses never revolt of their own accord, and they never revolt merely because they are oppressed. Indeed, so long as they are not permitted to have standards of comparison, they never even become aware that they are oppressed. The recurrent economic crises of past times were totally unnecessary and are not now permitted to happen, but other and equally large dislocations can and do happen without having political results because there is no way in which discontent can become articulate. As for the problem of overproduction, which has been latent in our society since the development of machine technique, it is solved by the device of continuous warfare, see Chapter 3, which is also useful in keying up public morale to the necessary pitch. From the point of view of our present rulers, therefore, the only genuine dangers are the splitting off of a new group of able, underemployed, power-hungry people and the growth of liberalism and skepticism in their own ranks. That is a powerful statement. I just lost it. Where is it at? From the point of view of our present rulers, therefore, the only genuine dangers are the splitting off of a new group of able, unemployed, they have to be unemployed, right? Power-hungry people and the growth of liberalism and skepticism in their own ranks. The problem, that is to say, is educational. It is a problem of continuously molding the consciousness both of the directing people and of the larger executive group that lies immediately below it. The consciousness of the masses needs only to be influenced in a negative way. Given this background, one could infer, if one did not know it already, the general structure of oceanic society. At the apex of the pyramid comes Big Brother. Big Brother is infallible and all-powerful. Every success, every achievement, every victory, every scientific discovery, all knowledge, all wisdom, all happiness, all virtue are held to issue directly from his leadership and inspiration. Nobody has ever seen Big Brother. He is a face on the hoardings, a voice on the telescreen. We may be reasonably sure that he will never die, and there is already considerable uncertainty as to when he was born. Big Brother is the guise in which the party chooses to exhibit itself to the world. His function is to act as a focusing point for love, fear, reverence, emotions, which are more easily felt towards an individual than towards an organization. Below Big Brother comes the inner party, its numbers limited to 6 million, or something less than 2% of the population of Oceania. Below the inner party comes the outer party, which, if the inner party is described as the brain of the state, may be justly likened to the hands. Below that come the dumb masses whom we habitually refer to as the proles, numbering perhaps 85% of the population. In the terms of our earlier classification, the proles are the low. For the slave population of the equatorial lands, who pass constantly from conqueror to conqueror, are not a permanent or necessary part of the structure. In principle, membership of these three groups is not hereditary. The child of inner party parents is, in theory, not born into the inner party. Admission to either branch of the party is by examination, taken at the age of 16. Nor is there any racial discrimination or any marked domination of one province by another. Jews, Negroes, South Americans of pure Indian blood are to be found in the highest ranks of the party, and the administrators of any area are always drawn from the inhabitants of that area. In no part of Oceania do the inhabitants have the feeling that they are a colonial population ruled from a distant capital. Oceania has no capital. It is titular head, is a person whose whereabouts nobody knows, except that English is its chief lingua franca, a newspeak its official language. It is not centralized in any way. Its rulers are not held together by blood ties, but by adherence to a common doctrine. It is true that our society is stratified, and very rigidly stratified, on what at first sight appear to be hereditary lines. There is far less to and fro movement between the different groups than happened under capitalism, or even in the pre-industrial age. Between the two branches of the party, there is a certain amount of interchange, but only so much as will ensure that weaklings are excluded from the inner party and the ambitious members of the outer party are made harmless by allowing them to rise. Proletarians, in practice, are not allowed to graduate into the party. The most gifted among them, who might possibly become nuclei of discontent, are simply marked down by the thought police and eliminated. But this state of affairs is not necessarily permanent, nor is it a matter of principle. The party is not a class in the old sense of the word. It does not aim at transmitting power to its own children as such. And if there were no other way of keeping the ablest people at the top, it would be perfectly prepared to recruit an entire new generation from the ranks of the proletariat. In the crucial years, the fact that the party was not a hereditary body did a great deal to neutralize opposition. The older kind of socialists, who had been trained to fight against something called class privilege, assumed that what is not hereditary cannot be permanent. He did not see that the continuity of an oligarchy need not be physical, nor did he pause to reflect that hereditary, what's the word again, Babylon, aristocracies? Yes.
That's
have
right.
always,
aristocracy.
Huh? Aristocracies. Oh, I have a hard time with that one. Aristocracies. Okay. So, aristocracies. He did not see the continuity of an oligarchy need not be physical, nor did he pause to reflect that hereditary.
Aristocracies.
Aristocracies have always short-lived. Whereas adoptive organizations such as the Catholic Church have sometimes lasted for hundreds or thousands of years. The essence of oligarchical rule is not father-to-son inheritance, but the persistence of a certain worldview and a certain way of life imposed by the dead upon the living. A ruling group is a ruling group, so long as it can nominate its successors. You peep that?
Yes, done. Dead forces living. Six ether forces and all.
The party is not concerned with perpetuating its blood, but with perpetuating itself. Who wields power is not important, provided that the hierarchical structure remains always the same. All the beliefs, habits, taste, emotions, mental attitudes that characterize our time are really designed to sustain the mystique of the party and prevent the true nature of present-day society from being perceived. Physical rebellion or any preliminary move towards rebellion is at present not possible. From the proletarians, nothing is to be feared. Left to themselves, they will continue from generation to generation and from century to century, working, breeding, and dying, not only without any impulse to rebel, but without the power of grasping that the world could be other than it is. Mm. They could only become dangerous if the advance of an industrial technique made it necessary to educate them more highly, but since military and commercial rivalry are no longer important, the level of popular education is actually declining.
Don, could you read that last line again?
Please? I certainly can. Okay, back to the prose. They could only become dangerous if the advance of industrial technique made it necessary to educate them more highly. But since military and commercial rivalry are no longer important, the level of popular education is actually declining. What opinions the masses hold or do not hold is looked on as a matter of indifference. They can be granted intellectual liberty because they have no intellect. And a party member, on the other hand, not even the smallest deviation of opinion on the most unimportant subject can be tolerated. A party member lives from birth to death under the eye of the thought police. Even when he is alone, he can never be sure that he is alone. Wherever he may be, asleep or awake, working or resting, in his bath or in bed, he can be inspected without warning and without knowing that he is being inspected. Nothing that he does is indifferent. His friendships, his relaxations, his behavior towards his wife and children, the expression of his face when he is alone, the words he mutters in sleep, even the characteristic movements of his body are all jealously scrutinized. Not only any actual misdemeanor, but any eccentricity. God damn. Cut. Take it back. I know this word. I can't pronounce it tonight. Eccentricity, or you know what the fuck I mean. Eccentricity. Thank you. However small, any change of habits, any nervous mannerism that could possibly be the symptom of an inner struggle is certain to be detected. He has no freedom of choice in any direction whatever. On the other hand, his actions are not regulated by law or by any clearly formulated code of behavior. In Oshina, there is no law. Thoughts and actions, which, when detected, mean certain deaths are not formally forbidden, and the endless purges, arrests, tortures, imprisonments, and vaporization are not inflicted as punishment for crimes which have actually been committed, but are merely the wiping out of persons who might perhaps commit a crime at some time in the future. Minority Report.
Yep.
What's my thing that my man did? Obama? Crime something? Is it thought crime?
Yep.
What the fuck Obama did Obama put in place? What is it called? Crime something. I think that shit is
thought
called thought crime.
Thought crime, ain't it done?
I think it's thought crime. I think that's what it's called, thought crime.
I remember seeing it. I'll type it into the computer if ain't nobody else doing it.
Yeah, I've had it on Georgia Gossip for a long time, but somebody, it's gone now. A party member is required to have not only the right opinions, but the right instincts. Many of the beliefs and attitudes demanded of him are never plainly stated and could not be stated without laying bare the contradictions inherent in INSOC. If he is a person naturally orthodox and newspeak, a good thinker, he will, in all circumstances, know, without taking thought, what is the true belief or the desirable emotion. But in any case, an elaborate mental training undergone in childhood and grouping itself around the newspeak words crime stop, black, white, and double think makes him unwilling and unable to think too deeply on any subject whatever. A party member is expected to have no private emotions and no respite from enthusiasm. He is supposed to live in a continuous frenzy of hatred of foreign enemies and internal traitors, triumph over victories, and self-abasement before the power and wisdom of the party. The discontents produced by his bare, unsatisfying life are deliberately turned outwards and dissipated by such devices as the two-minute hate, and the speculation which might possibly induce a skeptical or rebellious attitude are killed in advance by his early acquired inner discipline. The first and simplest stage in the discipline, which can be taught even to young children, is called in newspeak crime stop. Crime stop means the faculty of stopping short, as though by instinct, at the threshold of any dangerous thought. It includes the power of not grasping analogies, of failing to perceive logical errors, of misunderstanding the simplest arguments if they are, here's your word, inimical to INSOC, and of being bored or repelled by any train of thought which is capable of leading in a heretical direction. Crime stop, in short, means protective stupidity. But stupidity is not enough. On the contrary, orthodoxy in the full sense demands a control over one's own mental process as complete as that of a contortionist over his body. Oceanic society rests ultimately on the belief that Big Brother is omnipotent and that the party is infallible. But since in reality Big Brother is not omnipotent and the party is not infallible, there is need for an unwearying moment-to-moment flexibility in the treatment of facts. The key word here is black-white. Like so many newspeak words, this word has two mutually contradictory meanings. Applied to an opponent, it means the habit of impudently claiming that black is white, in contradiction of the plain facts. Applied to a party member, it means a loyal willingness to say that black is white when party discipline demands this. But it means also the ability to believe that black is white, and more to know that black is white, and to forget that one has ever believed the contrary. This demands a continuous alteration of the past, made possible by the system of thought, which really embraces all the rest, and which is known in newspeak as doublethink. The alteration of the past is necessary for two reasons, one of which is subsidiary and, so to speak, precautionary. The subsidiary reason is that the party member, like the proletarian, tolerates present-day conditions partly because he has no standards of comparison. He must be cut off from the past, just as he must be cut off from foreign countries, because it is necessary for him to believe that he is better off than his ancestors and that the average level of material comfort is constantly rising. But by far, the more important reason for the readjustment of the past is the need to safeguard the infallibility of the party. It is not merely that speeches, statistics, and records of every kind must be constantly brought up to date in order to show that the predictions of the party were in all cases right. It is also that no change in doctrine or in political alignment can ever be admitted. For to change one's mind or even one's policy is a confession of weakness. If, for an example, Eurasia or East Asia, whichever it may be, is the enemy today, then that country must always have been the enemy. And if the facts say otherwise, then the facts must be altered. Thus, history is continuously rewritten. This day-to-day falsification of the past carried out by the Minister of Truth is as necessary to the stability of the regime as the work of repression and espionage carried out by the Ministry of Love. The mutability of the past is the central tenet of INSOC. Past events, it is argued, have no objective existence, but survive only in written records and in human memories. The past is whatever the records and the memories agree upon. And since the party is in full control of all records and in equally full control of the minds of its members, it follows that the past is whatever the party chooses to make it. It also follows that though the past is alterable, it never has been altered in any specific instance. For when it has been recreated in whatever shape is needed at the moment, then this new version is the past. And no different past can ever have existed. This holds good even when, as often happens, the same events has to be altered out of recognition several times in the course of a year. At all times, the party is in possession of absolute truth, and clearly the absolute can never have been different from what it is now. It will be seen that the control of the past depends above all on the training of memory. To make sure that all written records agree with the orthodoxy of the moment is merely a mechanical act, but it is also necessary to remember that events happen in the desired manner. And if it is necessary to rearrange one's memories or to tamper with written records, then it is necessary to forget that one has done so. The trick of doing this can be learned like any other mental technique. It is learned by the majority of party members, and certainly by all who are intelligent as well as orthodox. In old speak, it is called, quite frankly, reality control. In new speak, it is called double think, though double think comprises much else as well. Double think means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. The party, you know what, I didn't know that. That's some deep shit devil thing. Holding two means holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. So that's like somebody says, is it like, I don't believe there is a God, but I believe there is a higher power.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what the fuck that shit is. That's a double thing like a motherfucker. The power. power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and making them accept both of them.
I don't like white people, but I have a friend who's white.
Oh, I never think. I hate men, but I'm married to one.
That's crazy.
Can't live without them. Okay. This is incredible. Simon, they both contradicted each other. Huh?
Yeah, this whole part that you read in this from when Five Liners did the introduction. This whole part right here is like the crux of that introduction.
Yeah, the appendix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so freaking good, Fireliners.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, doublethink means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. The party intellectual knows in which direction his memories must be altered. He therefore knows that he is playing tricks with reality, but by the exercise of double think, he also satisfies himself that reality is not violated. The process has to be conscious, or it would not be carried out with sufficient precision. But it also has to be unconscious, or it would bring with it a feeling of falsity and hence of guilt. Doublethink lies at the very heart of insoc, since the essential act of the party is to use conscious deception while retaining the firmness of purpose that goes with complete honesty. To tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed, to deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies. All this is indispensably necessary. Even in using the word double think, it is necessary to exercise double think. For by using the word, one admits that one is tampering with reality. By a fresh act of double think, one erases this knowledge, and so on indefinitely. With the lie always one leap ahead of the truth. Good God Almighty. The lie is always one leap ahead of the truth.
That's
ultimately,
right.
This is sad. It makes you want to cry. Ultimately, it is by means of double think that the party has been able and may, for all we know, continue to be able for thousands of years to arrest the course of history. All past oligarchies have fallen from power either because they ossified or because they grew soft. Either they became stupid and arrogant, failed to adjust themselves to changing circumstances, and were overthrown, or they became liberal and cowardly, made concessions when they should have used force, and once again were overthrown. They fail, that is to say, either through consciousness or through unconsciousness. It is the achievement of the party to have produced a system of thought in which both conditions can exist simultaneously. And upon no other intellectual basis could the dominion of the party be made permanent. If one is to rule and to continue ruling, one must be able to dislocate the sense of reality. For the secret of rulership is to combine a belief in one's own infallibility with the power to learn from past mistakes. Incredible. It need hardly be said that the subtlest practitioners of doublethink are those who invented doublethink and know that it is a vast system of mental cheating. In our society, those who have the best knowledge of what is happening are also those who are furthest from seeing the world as it is. In general, the greater the understanding, the greater the delusion. The more intelligent the less sane. Ain't that the truth? One clear illustration of this is the fact that war hysteria increases in intensity as one rises in the social scale. Those whose attitude towards the war is most nearly rational are the subjects, are the subject peoples of disputed territories. To these people, the war is simply a continuous calamity which sweeps to and fro over their bodies like a tidal wave. Which side is winning is a matter of complete indifference to them. They are aware that a change of overlordship means simply that they will be doing the same work as before for new masters who treat them in the same manner as the old ones. The slightly more favored workers, whom we call the pros, are only intermittently conscious of the war. When it is necessary, they can be prodded into frenzies of fear and hatred. But when left to themselves, they are capable of forgetting for long periods that the war is happening. It is in the ranks of the party, and above all of the inner party, that the true war enthusiasm is found. World conquest is believed in most firmly by those who know it to be possible. World conquest is believed in most firmly by those who know it to be impossible. This peculiar leaking together of opposites, knowledge with ignorance, cynicism with fanaticism, is one of the chief distinguishing marks of oceanic society. The official ideology abounds with contradictions even when there is no practical reason for them. Thus, the party rejects and vilifies every principle for which the socialist movement originally stood, and it chooses to do this in the name of socialism. It preaches a contempt for the working class, unexampled for centuries past, and it dresses its members in a uniform which was at one time peculiar to manual workers and was adopted for that reason. It systematically undermines the solidarity of the family, and it calls its leader by name, which is a direct appeal to the sentiment of family loyalty. Even the names of the four ministries by which we are governed exhibit a sort of impudence in their deliberate reversal of the facts. The Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war, the Ministry of Truth with lies, the Ministry of Love with torture, and the Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental, nor do they result from ordinary hypocrisy. They are deliberately exercised in doublethink, for it is only by reconciling contradictions that power can be retained indefinitely. In no other way could the ancient cycle be broken. If human equality is to be forever averted, if the high, as we have called them, are to keep their places permanently, then the prevailing mental conditions must be controlled, must be controlled insanity. But there is one question which until this moment we have almost ignored. It is, why should human equality be averted? Supposing that the mechanics of the process have been rightly described, what is the motive for this huge, accurately planned effort to freeze history at a particular moment of time? Here we reach the central secret. As we have seen, the mystique of the party, and above all of the inner party, depends upon doublethink. But deeper than this lies the original motive, the never-questioned instinct that first led to the seizure of power and brought doublethink, the thought police, continuous warfare, and all of the other necessary paraphernalia into existence afterwards. This motive really consists. Winston became aware of silence, as one becomes aware of a new sound. It seemed to him that Julia had been very still for some time past. She was lying on her side, naked from the waist upward, with her cheek pillowed on her hand and one dark lock tumbling across her eyes. Her breast rose and fell slowly, regularly, Julia. No answer. Julia, are you awake? No answer. She was asleep. He shut the book, put it carefully on the floor, lay down, and pulled the coverlet over both of them. He had still, he reflected, not learned the ultimate secret. He understood how. He did not understand why. Chapter 1, like Chapter 3, had not actually told him anything that he did not know. It had merely systematized the knowledge that he possessed already. But after reading it, he knew better than before that he was not mad. Being in a minority, even a minority of one, did not make you mad. There was truth, and there was untruth. And if you clung to the truth even against the whole world, you were not mad. A yellow beam from the sinking sun slanted in through the window and fell across the pillow. He shut his eyes. The sun on his face and the girl's smooth body touching his own gave him a strong, sleepy, confident feeling. He was safe. Everything was all right. He fell asleep, murmuring, "Sanity is not statistical," with the feeling that this remark contained in it a profound wisdom. When he woke, it was the sensation of having slept for a long time, but a glance at the old-fashioned clock told him that it was only 20:30. He lay dozing for a while. Then the usual deep singing struck up from the yard below. It was only an opless fancy. It passed like an April dye, but a look in a word in the dreams they stirred, the off stole my art away. The driveling song seemed to have kept its popularity. You still heard it all over the place. It had outlived the hate song. Julia woke at the sound, stretched herself luxuriously, and got out of bed. "I'm hungry," she said. "Let's make some coffee." "Damn, the stove gone out, and the water's cold." She picked the stove up and shook it. "There's no oil in it." "We can get some from old Sherrington, I expect. The funny thing is, I made sure it was full. I'm going to put my clothes on," she added. "It seems to have gotten colder." Winston also got up and dressed himself. The indefatigable voice sang on. The indefatigable voice sang on. "They say that time heals all things. They say you can always forget. But the smiles and the tears across the years, they twist my art strings yet." As he fastened the belt of his overalls, he strolled across to the window. The sun must have gone down behind the houses. It was not shining into the yard any longer. The flagstones were wet as though they had just been washed, and he had the feeling that the sky had been washed too. So fresh and pale was the blue between the chimney pots. Tirelessly, the woman marched to and fro, corking and uncorking herself, singing and falling silent, and pegging out more diapers and more and yet more. He wondered whether she took in washing for a living, or was merely the slave of 20 or 30 grandchildren. Julia had come across to his side. Together they gazed down with a sort of fascination at the sturdy figure below. As he looked at the woman in her characteristic attitude, her thick arms reaching up for the line, her powerful mare like buttocks protruded, it struck him for the first time that she was beautiful. It had never before occurred to him that the body of a woman of 50, blown up to monstrous dimensions by childbearing, then hardened, roughened by work till it was coarse in the grain like an overripe turnip, could be beautiful. But it was so, and after all, he thought, why not? The solid, contourless body, like a block of granite, and the rasping red skin bore the same relation to the body of a girl as the rose hip to the rose. Why should the fruit be held inferior to the flower? "She's beautiful," he murmured. She's a meter across the hips, easily, said Julia. That is her style of beauty, said Winston. He held Julia's supple waist easily encircled by his arm. From the hip to the knee, her flank was against his. Out of their bodies, no child would ever come. That was the one thing they could never do. Only by word of mouth, from mind to mind, could they pass on the secret. The woman down there had no mind. She had only strong arms, a warm heart, and a fertile belly. He wondered how many children she had given birth to. It might easily be 15. She had her momentary flowering, a year perhaps, of wild rose beauty, and then she had suddenly swollen like a fertilized fruit and grown hard and red and coarse, and then her life had been laundering, scrubbing. Wait, I missed something. Then her long life had been laundering, scrubbing, darning, cooking, sweeping, polishing, mending, scrubbing, laundering, first for the children. First for children and then for grandchildren, over 30 unbroken years. At the end of it, she was still singing. The mystical reverence that he felt for her was somehow mixed up with the aspect of the pale, cloudless sky stretching away behind the chimney pots into interminable distance. It was curious to think that the sky was the same for everybody, in Eurasia or East Asia as well as here. And the people under the sky were also very much the same, everywhere, all over the world, hundreds of thousands of millions of people just like this, people ignorant of one another's existence, held apart by walls of hatred and lies, and yet almost exactly the same, people who had never learned to think, but who were storing up in their hearts and bellies and muscles and muscled the power that would one day overturn the world. If there was hope, it lay in the prose. Without having read to the end of the book, he knew that that must be Goldstein's final message, that must be Goldstein's final message. The future belonged to the prose. And could he be sure that when their time came, the world they constructed would not be just as alien to him, Winston Smith, as the world of the party? Yes, because at least it would be a world of sanity. Where there is equality, there can be sanity. Sooner or later, it would happen. Strength would change into consciousness. The pros were immortal. You cannot doubt it when you looked at that valiant figure in the yard. In the end, their awakening would come. And until that happened, though it might be 1,000 years, they would stay alive against all the odds, like birds, passing on from body to body the vitality which the party did not share and could not kill. Do you remember, he said, the thrush that sang to us that first day at the edge of the wood? He wasn't singing to us, said Julia. He was singing to please himself. Not even that. He was just singing. The birds sang. The pros sang. The party did not sing. All around the world, in London and New York and Africa and Brazil and in the mysterious forbidden lands beyond the frontiers, in the streets of Paris and Berlin, in the villages of the endless Russian plain, in the bazaars of China and Japan, everywhere stood the same solid, unconquerable figure, made monstrous by work and childbearing, toiling from birth to death and still singing. Out of those mighty loins, a race of conscious beings must one day come. You were dead. Theirs was the future. But you could share in that future if you kept alive the mind as they kept alive the body and passed on the secret doctrine that 2 + 2 = 4. We are dead, he said. We are dead, echoed Julia dutifully. You are dead, said an iron voice behind them. They sprang apart. Winston and Trails seemed to have turned into ice. he could see the white all around the irises of Julia's eyes. Her face had turned milky yellow. The smear of rouge that was still on each cheekbone stood out sharply, almost although unconnected with the skin beneath. You are the dead, repeated the iron voice. It was behind the picture, breathed Julia. It was behind the picture, said the voice. Remain exactly where you are. Make no movement until you are ordered. It was staring. It was starting at last. They could do nothing except stand gazing into one another's eyes. To run for life, to get out of the house before it was too late, no such thought occurred to them. Unthinkable to disobey the iron voice from the wall. There was a snap as though a catch had been turned back and a crash of breaking glass. The picture had fallen to the floor, uncovering the telescreen behind it. Now they can see us, said Julia. Now we can see you, said the voice. Stand out in the middle of the room. Stand back to back. Clasp your hands behind your heads. Do not touch one another. They were not touching, but it seemed to him that he could feel Julia's body shaking, or perhaps it was merely the shaking of his own. He could just stop his teeth from chattering, but his knees were beyond his control. There was a sound of trampling boots below, inside the house and outside. The yard seemed to be full of men. Something was being dragged across the stones. The women singing had stopped abruptly. There was a long rolling clang, as though the washtub had been flung across the yard, and then confusion of angry shouts, which ended in a yell of pain. The house is surrounded, said Winston. The house is surrounded, said the voice. He heard Julia snap her teeth together. I suppose we may as well say goodbye, she said. You may as well say goodbye, said the voice. And then another quite different voice, a thin, cultivated voice, which Winston had the impression of having heard before, struck in. And by the way, while we are on the subject, here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head. Something crashed onto the bed behind Winston's back. The head of a ladder had been thrust through the window and had burst into a frame. Someone was climbing through the window. There was a stampede of boots up the stairs. The room was full of solid men in black uniforms with iron-shod boots on their feet and truncheons in their hands. Winston was not trembling any longer. Even his eyes, he barely moved. One thing alone mattered, to keep still, and to not give them an excuse to hit you. A man with a smooth prize fighter jaw, in which the mouth was only a slit pause opposite, him balancing his truncheon meditatively between thumb and forefinger. Winston met his eyes. The feeling of nakedness, with one's hands behind one's head and one's face and body all exposed, was almost unbearable. The man protruded the tip of a white tongue, licked the place where his lips should have been, and then passed on. There was another crash. Someone had picked up the glass paperweight from the table and smashed it to pieces on the earth stone. The fragment of coral, a tiny crickle of pink like a sugar rosebud from a cake, rolled across the mat. How small, thought Winston. How small it always was. There was a gasp and a thump behind him, and he received a violent kick on the ankle, which nearly flung him off his balance. One of the men had smashed his fist into Julia's solar plexus, doubling her up like a pocket ruler. She was thrashing about on the floor, fighting for breath. Winston dared not turn his head even by a millimeter, but sometimes her livid, grasping face came within the angle of his vision. Even in his terror, it was as though he could feel the pain in his own body, the deadly pain which nevertheless was less urgent than the struggle to get back her breath. He knew what it was like, the terrible agonizing pain which was there all the while but could not be suffered yet, because before all else it was necessary to be able to breathe. Then the two men hoisted her up by knees and shoulders and carried her out of the room like a sack. Winston had a glimpse of her face, upside down, yellow and contorted, with the eyes shut and still with a smear of rouge on either cheek. And that was the last he saw of her. He stood dead still. No one had hit him yet. The thoughts of which came of their own accord, but seemed totally uninteresting, began to flit through his mind. He wondered whether they had got Mr. Charrington. He wondered what they had done to the woman in the yard. He noticed that the badly wanted, he noticed that he badly wanted to urinate and felt a faint surprise because he had done so only 2 or 3 hours ago. He noticed that the clock on the mantelpiece said 9, meaning 21, but the light seemed too strong. Would not the light be fading at 21 hours on an August evening? He wondered whether, after all, he and Julia had mistaken the time, had slept the clock round and thought it was 23, when really it was not 8:30 on the following morning. But he did not pursue the thought further. It was not interesting. There was another, lighter step in the passage. Mr. Charrington came into the room. The demeanor of the black uniformed men suddenly became more subdued. Something had also changed in Mr. Charrington's appearance. His eye fell on the fragments of the glass paperweight. "Pick up those pieces," he said sharply. A man stooped to obey. The Cockney accent had disappeared. Winston suddenly realized whose voice it was that he had heard a few moments ago on the telescreen. Mr. Charrington was still wearing his old velvet jacket, but his hair, which had been almost white, had turned black. Also, he was not wearing his spectacles. He gave Winston a single sharp glance, as though verifying his identity, and then paid no more attention to him. He was still recognizable, but he was not the same person any longer. His body had straightened and seemed to have grown bigger. His face had undergone only tiny changes that had nevertheless worked a complete transformation. The black eyebrows were less bushy. The wrinkles were gone. The whole lines of the face seemed to have altered. Even the nose seemed shorter. It was the alert, cold face of a man of about 35. It occurred to Winston that for the first time in his life, he was looking with knowledge at a member of the Thought Police. The fucking end, part 3. Oh, my God. Lord. God damn, set that nigga. Mr. Charrington was the thought undercover cop. Set motherfuckers up from the party.
Yep.
Yeah.
Heard everything, been watching everything.
Damn. What? We should continue.
No.
Yes. We should continue. The night is young, darling. Okay, this is a long chapter. Man, this was fucking good. We want to know what happened next, man. I don't want a cliffhanger.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Damn, it was just getting good. It's like commercial or see what happens next week. What the fuck?
All right.
Are you saying all right, Mrs. Griswold, we can?
Yes, absolutely, Dawn. You can continue. I'm going to tell you, though, I'm going to go to sleep here.
That's fine.
So, y'all go ahead.
Oh, yay. She let us have fun on her show. We can continue doing work. Okay, Babylon, you up?
Yep, I'm right here.
Don't be lying, nigga. One time you fell asleep on the show.
I ain't fall asleep. I'm right here, Don. I'm doing my thing. I can't even read along with you, so I'm really enjoying it.
Why you
I'm
can't
right
read along?
There. Because my fucking phone, man. Oh, this touch screen ain't for real men.
Man, you need. Hey, let me say this to you. You remember them bitches that were saying what I can't do for you? Make them hoes get your phone, honey. Let's put that on record. Put them bitches to work.
No, I mean, I got a good phone. I agree, Don. But, Don, I got a good phone. You know that. I'm just saying, like, my touch screen, I'm just not good with electronics.
Yeah, that's the same shit happens to me. My touch screen goes out, and once it goes out, ain't nothing I can do.
Yeah, then I have to wind up re-looking for the page and all that shit, running behind. I'd be there missed 10 minutes of your reading. So I might as well just listen.
Okay, so you're able to follow it, though? Because, I mean, you know, because
I
know a person
mean,
can
I
follow
mean,
it when they're reading. I don't know if a person can follow when they're not reading. I don't know.
Yeah, I like not reading sometimes because I be in the fucking scene. I was right there.
Me too. I was right there, too. You saw all that shit, nigga? I saw that shit. I was right in the fucking room when that shit happened.
Yeah.
I was there.
I saw the shaking fucking knees and everything, the shaking stomach. Fucking everything, just everything. Yeah, but that was a good chapter, man. Chapter 9 was a beast.
Man, that shit was the truth. Can we go on to the next one, Babylon? You gonna be with me, man? Because the fire line to go out.
I'm right here. I'm shutting up.
I'm top when her nigga come in. It's almost 12 o'clock. Her nigga be home, so you know she gotta pretend she innocent for a minute.
Oh, okay.
She come back to us.
Okay.
I know Neff routine. But Jay Wanna Antichrist, I Be That I Am. Who all with us in the chat room? Because if not, goddamn shit. Who all with us? The way you... Okay, Jay Wanna... Okay. Well, shit, let's run it. And then the people still on the line.
Yeah, and I got two things to say before you go ahead.
Guru's still with us. Hey, Guru, I see you, honey. Uh-huh.
What's up, Guru? Done. It's called a 2 minutes hate, right? 2 minutes hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? Okay, so now, you know Barack Obama had the hate crime, and what you asked me about was the pre-crime, right? Basically pre-crime?
Mm-hmm.
Thought crimes? Okay, yeah, I had looked
it
up.
Yeah, oh, it's called pre-crime. Thank you. That's what it's called, pre-crime.
Yeah.
And it's based on a nigga thought.
Yeah, and Barack Obama signed that in October. I'm getting to October
28,
2009.
Okay, I remember when that nigga was. He wasn't even fucking a year in president yet. That nigga did that thought crime on that pre-crime on a motherfucker. Pre-crime law. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Pre-crime law.
Just like on goddamn Minority Report. Just like this Minority Report. People don't even know what Minority Report means. So can I get that revelation? Not. Minority used to be in regards to, like, when we say we the 1%. That was the minority. That's why even in this book.
Yeah, but the minority report is the 1% now, ain't it?
Yeah, a report from them. Mm-hmm. From the highest levels, the Minority Report.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means.
And the thought police will come in and bust a nigga on Minority Report. They'll come in and get a nigga before he even commit the crime.
Damn right. And throw that fucking net on his ass and his ass go to sleep. That shit is ugly. I don't blame my Tom Cruise for hauling ass. But it was like, don't run. He was like, everybody run. Fuck that shit. Yeah, but Don, the last thing was double think. Now, if you ever have time to reread the part where you read Double Think, then that's the definition of the spell that's broken on something.
Uh-huh. I remember what they said about the definition. I remember that. I remember something like that. Yeah. I can't
scroll. Yeah,
and
the Double Think, that's the definition of the spell that people are under. That's the true fucking spell. That shit was great. But I'm ready, Don, if you're ready to read.
You game, Babylon.
I'm up. I'm game.
No, it's 2:30 Georgia time. You better not fall asleep
when
I read this shit.
Matter of fact, I'm up and I got a Red Bull in the refrigerator and I ain't even drinking. I love this book. I'm up. I love listening to this.
All right, goddamn shit. All right, here we go. Chapter 1 on part 3. This shit is good, ain't it? All right, here we go. He did not know where he was. Presumably, he was in the Ministry of Love, but there was no... I'm sorry. My desk is on fire. It's been smoking. I don't know where the smoke coming from and shit. I don't put a fire going around this bitch. Okay, wait a minute. I'm like, man, I thought I kept putting the cigarette out. It's just still on fire some goddamn where. Okay. He did not know where he was. Presumably, he was in the Ministry of Love, but there was no way of making certain. He was in a high-ceiling, windowless cell with walls of glittering white porcelain. Concealed lamps flooded it with cold light, and there was a low, steady humming sound, which he supposed had something to do with the air supply. A bench or shelf just wide enough to sit on ran around the wall, broken only by the door, and at the top, opposite the door, a lavatory pan with no wooden seat. There were four telescreens, one in each wall. There was a dual aching in his belly. It had been there ever since they had bundled him into the closed van and driven him away. But he was also hungry, with a gnawing, unwholesome kind of hunger. It might be 24 hours since he had eaten. It might be 36. He still did not know, probably never would know, whether it had been morning or evening when they arrested him. Since he was arrested, he has not been fed. He sat as still as he could on the narrow bench with his hands crossed on his knees. He had already learned to sit still. If you made unexpected movements that yelled at you from the telescreen. I'm sorry. If you made unexpected movements, they yelled at you from the telescreen. But the craving for food was growing upon him. What he longed for above all was a piece of bread. He had an idea that there were a few breadcrumbs in the pockets of his overalls. It was even possible, he thought this, because from time to time, something seemed to tickle his leg. That there might be a sizable bit of crust there. In the end, the temptation to find out overcame his fear. He slipped a hand into his pocket. Smith, yelled the voice from the telescreen. 6079, Smith W, hands out of your pockets, in the cells. He sat still again, his hands crossed on his knee. Before being brought here, he had been taken to another place, which must have been an ordinary prison or a temporary lockup used by the patrols. He did not know how long he had been there. Some hours at any rate, with no clocks and no daylight, it was hard to gauge the time. It was noisy, evil-smelling place. They had put him into a cell similar to the one he was now in, but filthily dirty, and at all times crowded by 10 or 15 people. The majority of them were common criminals, but there were a few political prisoners among them. He had sat silent against the wall, jostled by dirty bodies, too preoccupied by fear and the pain in his belly to take much interest in his surroundings, but still noticing the astonishing difference in demeanor between the party prisoners and the others. The party prisoners were always silent and terrified, but the ordinary criminals seemed to care nothing for anybody. They yelled insults at the guards, fought back fiercely when their belongings were impounded, wrote obscene words on the floor, ate smuggled food, which they produced from mysterious hiding places in their clothes, and even shouted down the telescreens when it tried to restore order. On the other hand, some of them seemed to be on good terms with the guards, called them by nicknames, and tried to whittle cigarettes through the spy hole in the door. The guards, too, treated the common criminals with a certain forbearance, even when they had to handle them roughly. There was much talk about the forced labor camps to which most of the prisoners expected to be sent. It was all right in the camps, he gathered. So as long as you had good contacts and knew the ropes, there was bribery, favoritism, and racketeering of every kind. There was homosexuality and prostitution. There was even illicit alcohol distilled from potatoes. The positions of trust were given only to the common criminals, especially the gangsters and the murderers who formed a sort of, what's the word, aristocracy? Babylon,
yes,
you alive?
Yep. That's
what's
right.
The word?
That's
say
right,
it. I need you to say it.
Aristocracy.
Okay. All right.
Aristocracy.
I had a problem with this fucking word. Hey, too. The position
but
of trust.
But you could say it aristocracy. Now, I don't know what the
aristocracy.
Fuck that is.
I like aristocracy better. I'm going to name my next child aristocracy. That's a powerful. That's beautiful. Aristocracy. What's your name, honey? Aristocracy. That's a bad name. I like that name. Anyway, the position of trust. Come on, too. We should name our baby that. Aristocracy. The position of trust were given only to the common criminals, especially the gangsters and the murderers, who formed a sort of aristocracy. All the dirty jobs were done by the politicals. There was a constant come and go of prisoners of every description, drug peddlers, thieves, bandits, black marketeers, drunks, prostitutes. Some of the drunks were so violent that the other prisoners had to combine to suppress them. An enormous wreck of women, aged about 60, with great tumbling breasts and thick coils of white hair, which had come down in her struggles, was carried in, kicking and shouting, by four guards who had hold of her, one of each corner. They wrenched off the boots with which she was been trying to kick them. They wrenched off the boots with which she had been trying to kick them and dumped her down across Winston's lap, almost breaking his thigh bone. The woman hoisted herself up, upright, and followed them out with a yell of, "Fuck you bastards!" Then noticing that she was sitting on something uneven, she slid off Winston's knee onto the bench. Oh, my God, this nigga in jail. Now, this is good. Now he got a jail story to tell.
Yeah.
"Beg pardon, dearie," she said. I wouldn't have sat on you. Only the buggers put me there. They don't know all to treat a lady, do they?" She paused, patted her breast, and belched. "Pardon," she said. "I ain't myself quite." She leaned forward and vomited copiously on the floor. Say what, Babylon?
Don't vomit, Don.
I actually got a fucking sound effect for vomit on the show. Got that already. Anyway. But she leaned forward and vomited coppishly on the floor. "That's better," she said, leaning back with closed eyes. "Never keep it down, that's what I say. Get it up while it's fresh on your stomach, like." She revived, turned to have another look at Winston, and seemed immediately to take a fancy to him. She put a vast arm round his shoulder and drew him towards her, breathing beer and vomit into his face. "What's your name, dearie?" she said. "Smith," said Winston. "Smith," said the woman. "That's funny. My name's Smith, too." "Why?" she added sentimentally. Why, I might be your mother." She might, thought Winston, to be his mother. She was about the right age and physique, and it was probably that people changed somewhat after 20 years in a forced labor camp. No one else had spoken to him. To a surprising extent, the ordinary criminals ignored the party prisoners. The Pollets, they called them, with a sort of uninterested contempt. The party prisoners seemed terrified of speaking to anybody, and above all, of speaking to one another. Only once, when two party members, both women, were pressed close together on the bench, he overheard amid the din of voices a few hurriedly whispered words, and in particular, a reference to something called Room 101. You see how they wrote that shit, Babylon?
Yeah. Hey,
they wrote it like, in the book they wrote it Room O-N-E-O-H-O-N-E, Room 101. That's how they wrote that shit. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they referenced something called Room 101. 101, Bab.
Okay.
Okay.
That's the key to figuring out the mathematical code, 101.
Mathematical code for the damn bowl.
No, Don, to everything. Now, y'all got it in the book, Don. I ain't going to go through that. That's
101, because that's also part of the binary system, right? The computer.
Yeah, 101.
Okay, got you.
And 101 is 19.
Okay, remember, I was talking about that damn bowl. Okay.
No, I'm talking about where he wrote in the Quran about the number 19. And we'll talk about it another day. I'm ready.
Okay. All right. So, of course, they was referencing something called Room 101, which he did not understand. It might be 2 or 3 hours ago that they had brought him here. The dual pain in his belly never went away, but sometimes it grew better and sometimes worse, and his thoughts expanded and contracted accordingly. When it grew worse, he thought only of the pain itself and of his desire for food. When it grew better, panic took hold of him. There were moments when he foresaw the things that would happen to him with such actuality that his heart galloped and his breath stopped. He felt the smash of truncheons on his elbows and iron-shod boots on his shins. He saw himself groveling on the floor, screaming for mercy through broken teeth. He hardly thought of Julia. He could not fix his mind on her. He loved her and would not betray her, but that was only a fact, known as he knew the rules of arithmetic. Nope. Is that arithmetic? Yeah, arithmetic. He felt no love for her, and he hardly even wondered what was happening to her. He thought oftener of O'Brien with the flickering hope. O'Brien might know that he had been arrested. The Brotherhood, he had said, never tried to save its members, but there was the razor blade. They would send the razor blade if they could. There would be perhaps 5 seconds before the guard could rush into the cell. The blade would bite into him with a sort of burning coldness, and even the fingers that held it would be cut to the bone. Everything came back to his sick body, which shrank, trembling from the smallest pain. He was not certain that he would use the razor blade even if he got the chance. It was more natural to exist from moment to moment, accepting another 10 minutes life, even when the certainty that there was torture at the end of it. Sometimes he tried to calculate the number of porcelain bricks in the wall of the cell. It should have been easy, but he always lost count at some point or another. More often he wondered where he was and what time of day it was. At one moment, he felt certain that it was broad daylight outside, and at the next, equally certain that it was pitch darkness. In this place, he knew instinctively, the lights would never be turned out. It was the place with no darkness. He saw now why O'Brien had seemed to recognize the illusions. In the Ministry of Love, there were no windows. His cell might be at the heart of the building or against its outer wall. It might be 10 floors below the ground or 30 above it. He moved himself mentally from place to place and tried to determine by the feeling of his body whether he was perched high in the air or buried deep under the ground. That's deep, right? This nigga kind of smart.
Yeah.
He kind of smart.
Absolutely.
To find out where he was based on his body temperature.
And the way, yeah.
There was a sound of marching boots outside. The steel door opened with a clang. A young officer, a trim black uniform figure who seemed to glitter all over with polished leather and whose pale, straight-featured face was like a wax mask, stepped smartly through the doorway. He motioned to the guards outside to bring in the prisoner they were leading. The poet, Ampleforth, shambled into the cell. I remember Ampleforth. You remember Ampleforth? The door clanged shut again. Ample Force made one or two uncertain movements from side to side, as though having some idea that there was another door to go out of, and then began to wander up and down the cell. He had not yet noticed Winston's presence. His troubled eyes were gazing at the wall about a meter above the level of Winston's head. He was shoeless. Large, dirty toes were sticking out of the holes of his socks. He was also several days away from a shave. A scrubby beard covered his face to the cheekbones, giving him an air of ruffianism that went oddly with his large, weak frame and nervous movements. Winston roused himself a little from his lethargy. He must speak to Ampleforth and risk the yell from the telescreen. It was even conceivable that Ampleforth was the bearer of the razor blade. Ampleforth, he said. There was no yell from the telescreen. Ampleforth. I'm sorry, he didn't yell that. My bad. I overacted on that part. Ampleforth paused and mildly started. His eyes focused and mildly startled. His eyes focused themselves slowly on Winston. Be quiet. Ah, Winston, he said. You too? What are you in for? To tell you the truth, he sat down awkwardly on the bench opposite of Winston. There is only one offense, is there not? He said. And have you committed it? Apparently I have. He put a hand to his forehead and pressed his temples for a moment, as though trying to remember something. These things happen, he began vaguely. I have been able to recall one instance, a possible instance. It was an indiscretion, undoubtedly. We were producing a definitive edition of the poems of Kipling. I allowed the word God to remain at the end of a line. I could not help it, he added, almost indignantly raising his face to look at Winston. It was impossible to change the line. The rhyme was rod. Do you realize that there are only 12 rhymes to rod in the entire language? There are only 12 rhymes to rod in the entire language. For days I had racked my brain. There was no other rhyme. Nigga had to put God in the poem book.
Yeah.
The expression of his face changed. The annoyance passed out of it. And for a moment he looked almost pleased. A sort of intellectual warmth, the joy of pendant who has found out some useless facts, shone through the dirt and scrubby hair. Has it ever occurred to you, he said, that the whole history of English poetry has been determined by the fact that the English language lacks rhymes? No, that particular thought had never occurred to Winston. No, that particular thought had never occurred to Winston, nor in the circumstances did it strike him as very important or interesting. Do you know what time of day it is? He said. Ampleforth looked startled again. I had hardly thought about it. They arrested me. It could be 2 days ago, perhaps three. His eyes flitted around the walls as though he half expected to find a window somewhere. There is no difference between night and day in this place. I don't see how one can calculate the time. They talked desultorily for some minutes. Then, without apparent reason, a yell from the telescreen bade them be silent. Winston sat quietly, his hands crossed. Ampleforth, too large to sit in a comfort on the narrow bench, fidgeted from side to side, clasping his lank hands first round one knee, then round the other. The telescreen barked at him to keep still. Time passed, 20 minutes, an hour. It was difficult to judge. Once more, there was a sound of boots outside. Winston and Trails contracted. Soon, very soon, perhaps in 5 minutes, perhaps now, the tramps of boots would mean that his own turn had come. The door opened. The cold-faced young officer stepped into the cell. With a brief movement of the hand, he indicated Ampleforth. Room 101, he said. Ampleforth marched clumsily out between the guards, his face vaguely perturbed but uncomprehending. What seemed like a long pass, the pain in Winston's belly had revived. His mind sagged round and round on the same trick, like a ball falling again and again into the same series of slots. He had only six thoughts: the pain in his belly, a piece of bread, the blood and the screaming, O'Brien, Julia, the razor blade. There was another spasm in his entrails. The heavy boots were approaching. As the door opened, the wave of air that it created brought in a powerful smell of cold sweat. Parsons walked into the cell. Parsons is one of the, that's one of the hard work. That's a little, that's a nigga with the kids in the nasty house and shit. Parsons walked into the cell. He was wearing khaki shorts and a sports shirt. This time, Winston was startled into self-forgetfulness. You here? He said. Parson gave Winston a glance in which there was neither interest nor surprise, but only misery. He began walking jerkily up and down, evidently unable to keep still. Each time he straightened his pudgy knees, it was a... Oh, that's why they said fucking that door opened. It was a smell of cold sweat. It was Parson. Stank ass. I get it now. Okay. Anyway, he began walking jerkily up and down, evidently unable to keep still. Each time he straightened his pudgy knees, it was apparent that they were trembling. His eyes had a wide-open, staring look, as though he could not prevent himself from gazing at something in the middle distance. "What are you in for?" said Winston. "Thought crime," said Parson, almost blubbering. The tone of his voice implied at once a complete admission of his guilt and a sort of incredulous horror that such a word could be applied to himself. Also, it's more like, "What are you in for?" "Thought crime." Like, you know how the nigga was? Like, "Thought crime, man. Fucked up, bad, man. Fucking goddamn thought, man. It's bullshit. They got me." Like,
yeah, you know what fucked up look like.
You know what I'm saying? That's how I was when I went. They asked me what I was in for. I was like, "Man, stealing. Like, that shit is terrible. You don't ever want to go to jail for stealing. Like, who does that shit? You want to go to jail for some major shit. You get no respect for being a fucking thief in jail." You know what I'm saying? Like, right? There's no fucking respect. Right? You got to be like, "Killed the motherfucker. Matter of fact, I took three motherfuckers out. They were all cops. That's what I'm in this bitch for."
Yeah, like some shit. Respect.
Respect.
Tell
the
nigga at my house, you know what I'm saying?
Hell yeah.
Tell the nigga at my house. Push the nigga down, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Hell yeah, goddamn.
That shit crazy. But you're right, though. It's certain shit get street cred. Nigga, my goddamn radio, like, my car just got stolen about 2 weeks ago in a goddamn shopping center parking lot. What you talking about, nigga? Damn.
Exactly, right?
Now, that's a beef right here. Now,
no, let me tell you, though, Babylon, that's exactly what happened to me, though. What you just said. Because after I stole the car, I took it and I hid it, right? And I got caught anyway. With a car that I already had that was stolen. You know, so I was ditching the old stolen car for a new stolen car that I was about to steal. So I ditched the stolen car and got the new car, and then they locked me up. But, you know what I'm saying, in the stolen car, the new stolen car is, you know what I'm saying, where I stay. So when they locked me up, all you see is this, like an hour later, this big-ass fat black cop comes in and sit at the desk, and he's like, "Man, my fucking car got stolen." The nigga said, "Man, they done stole my car, man." I'm saying to myself, "Man, this nigga lying, trying to make me confess to another car theft. I'm not doing it." And the nigga was like, and the other cop was like, "For real? What were you?" He was like, "Man, I was at the mall. That's why I stole the car at the mall, right?" And then I was like, "Man, this nigga trying to get me to confess to two fucking car thefts. I'm not going to do it in one day." And then the motherfucker called his wife. That's when I knew that shit was real. That nigga was like, man, I gotta call my wife. Because mind you, it was a baby car seat in it, CDs. We just threw the baby car seat out in the parking lot, just kept pushing. You got in the fucking car and took it. So when a nigga called his wife, that was the end of it. The nigga was like, baby, you ain't gonna believe this. Man, I went to the mall, baby. Give me something to eat, man. Came back, my damn car gone. So,
yeah.
We done stole the fucking police car. I didn't even fucking know it. Like, I done took the fucking police car shouting. And I'm sitting in that motherfucker, and he was like, and so the other guy, because the cop obviously didn't know why the fuck we're there. Mind you, you know, fucking juveniles, but we're in the police station in Union City, Shannon Mall. And the nigga was like, so the cop was like, well, hell, these motherfuckers, we got these little fucking juveniles right here that stole some cars. And they were like, you stole his car? Where his car at? We was like, man, we still. Like, we ain't steal no car. I ain't steal no car. We ain't steal no car. We still innocent. You know, we watched enough Boys in the Hood and shit like that, Minister Society, and know to shut the fuck up. Big up for those movies. You know what I'm saying? It came out in the fucking 90s.
All right.
That shit was important for us to fucking learn when you fucking taking
fuck
in and
cop.
Shit. You are fucking innocent.
Yeah.
You ain't did nothing, shouted. Yep, but yeah, it was the fucking police car. Stole that motherfucker. That nigga got there. I'm fucking, like, I can't believe. It was a nice Cutlass. Who would have thought, you know? It was Cutlass. It was his wife's car. It was his wife's car with the baby car seat.
These goddamn police these days drive a Saturn. These niggas so goddamn good.
And Dodge. Goddamn, they saw that Dodge Ram or what that shit called? That charging shit?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I'm so glad I'm grown now. Because there'd be a whole bunch of police cars getting fucking got by me if I was a teenager. Anyway, I know Antichrist. What the fuck is this? Still a police
car.
Who does that?
Now we're back to the book.
Back to the book. Thank you, honey. My life, it should be in a book or in a movie, boy. You don't think, okay, so here's the question now. Okay, so, you know, the nigga don't even want to say thought crime, Parson. So he paused opposite. Winston had began eagerly appealing to him. You don't think they'll shoot me, do you, old chap? They don't shoot you if you haven't actually done anything, only thoughts, which you can't help. I don't know. I know they give you a fair hearing. Oh, I trust them for that. They'll know my record, won't they? You know what kind of chap I was? You know what kind of chap I was? Not a bad chap in my way. Not brainy, of course, but keen. I tried to do my best for the party, didn't I? I'll get off with 5 years, don't you think? Or even 10 years. A chap like me could make himself pretty useful in a labor camp. They wouldn't shoot me for going off the rails just once. Are you guilty? Winston said. Course I'm guilty, cried Parson with a servile glance at the telescreen. This motherfucker. This is the typical fucking human being that admits they're guilty. And then he looked at the telescreen and said that shit. I never went to court and said I was guilty. I want to put that on record. And I never will. You don't
ain't nothing worse than a nigga that come to jail or cracker, any race, I don't see them in all colors and flavors. They come to jail and want to discuss their case with another nigga that's in jail, man. Stop doing that dumb shit, man.
Yeah, and now this nigga, yeah, of course I'm guilty, and looking at the telescreen saying it.
I love that shit right now. That gangster shit.
This nigga's a law-abiding motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? Just truthful all the way around.
Yeah.
And then he says, you don't think the party would arrest an innocent man, do you? His frog-like face grew calmer and even took on a slightly sanctimonious expression. Thought crime is a dreadful thing, old man, he said sententiously. It's insidious. It can get hold of you without you even knowing it. Do you know how it got a hold of me? In my sleep. Yes, that's a fact. There I was, working away, trying to do my bit. Never knew I had any bad stuff in my mind at all. And then I started talking in my sleep. Do you know what they heard me saying?
Just some bullshit.
He sank his voice like someone who is obliged for medical reasons to utter an obscenity. Down with Big Brother. Yes, I said that. I said it over and over again, it seems. Between you and me, old man, I'm glad they got me before it went any further. Do you know what I'm going to say to them when I go up before the tribunal? Thank you. I'm going to say thank you for saving me before it was too late.
Exactly. I like your attitude.
Goddamn, that pause it. Watch when Winter said. That was smooth, ain't it?
Yeah. Because, I mean, right now he acting human, but the thing that I like about him is kind of like, the thing that I like about what he said, he caught so he ain't got no fear. He ain't up there worried about what the fuck they going to do. He planning on what he going to fucking do.
Yeah, and he's loyal to them, though. You know what I'm saying? He don't ever want to go against them anyway. So, he's like a staunch Christian. That's like when a Christian do wrong. I'm talking about them stars. I'm talking about the real ones, and they ask God to show mercy on them. See, when I do wrong, I don't ask nobody for shit. I just hide the fact that I did wrong. You feel me? But I ain't finna get on my knees and be like, please show mercy.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying?
Man,
you ain't finna know I did that shit.
No, that's sick, though. That's
what he's doing. So he's going to be at their mercy saying, thank you. I'm going to say thank you for saving me before it was too late. I mean, like, because I damn sure don't want to be down with Big Brother.
Mm-mm.
Winston asked him, Mom, who denounced you? Said Winston. It was my little daughter, said Parson with a sort of doleful pride. His little spy child. He said, she listened at the keyhole, heard what I was saying, and nipped off to the patrols the very next day. Pretty smart for a nipper of 7, hey? I don't bear her any grudge for it. In fact, I'm proud of her. It shows I brought her up in this right spirit anyway. In the right spirit. You gotta love Farson.
This nigga is straight up dedicated, child. I love this shit.
I know it. That's just like a nigga that finally realized once he been locked up, like his baby mama, his mama put his ass in jail, and he say, you know what? I ain't even mad at my mama or my baby mama for calling police on me now, man. I'm proud of her.
Yeah. I'm here for a reason, Shawty. God got me here for a reason, Shawty. I came home, though. Shit, man, get the fuck out
I'm glad the bitch turned me in.
That's some bullshit. You don't hear that shit come from me.
This is my daughter. This is my child who I'm well pleased with. Sound familiar? Who I'm very pleased with.
Absolutely.
This is incredible. Hold on. Okay. So he says, it shows I brought her up in the right spirit anyway. He made a few more jerky movements up and down several times, casting a longing glance at the lavatory pan. Then he suddenly ripped down his shorts. Excuse me, old man, he said. I can't help it. It's the waiting. Oh, my God. I can pee in public and be exposed like that. I'd rather pee on myself and sit in my piss.
Mm-mm.
I would. I would not. I would pee on myself. I would not pull down my pants and piss in no damn wide open shit. No, I will pee on myself. I will pee on myself. That's how much shame I got for my nudity. Anyway, nigga said, excuse me, old man. He said, I can't help it. It's the waiting. He plumped his large posterior into the lavatory pan. Oh, my God. He's taking a shit. Winston covered his face with his hands. Smith! Yelled the voice from the telescreen. 6079 Smith W. Uncover your fucking face. No face is covered in the cells, motherfucker. Winston uncovered his face. Parson used the lavatory loudly and abundantly. It then turned out that the plug was defective and the cell stank abominably for hours afterwards. Parson was removed. More prisoners came and went, mysteriously. One, a woman, was consigned to room 101, and Winston noticed seemed to shrivel and turned a different color when she heard the words. A time came when it had been morning when he was brought here. It would be afternoon, or if it had been afternoon, then it would be midnight. There were six prisoners in the cell, men and women, all sat very still. Opposite Winston, there sat a man with a chinless, toothy face, exactly like that of the some large, harmless rodent. His fat, mottled cheeks were so pouched at the bottom that it was difficult not to believe that he had little stores of food tucked away there. His pale gray eyes flitted timorously from face to face and turned quickly away again when he caught anyone's eye. The door opened, and another prisoner was brought in whose appearance sent a momentary chill through Winston. He was a commonplace, mean-looking man who might have been an engineer or technician of some kind. But what was startling was the emaciation of his face. It was like a skull. Because of his thinness, the mouth and eyes looked disproportionately large, and the eyes seemed filled with murderous, unappeasable hatred of somebody or something. The man sat down on the bench at a little distance from Winston. Winston did not look at him, but the tormented, skull-like face was as vivid in his mind as though it had been straight in front of his eyes. Suddenly, he realized what was the matter. The man was dying of starvation. The same thought seemed to occur almost simultaneously to everyone in the cell. There was a very faint staring all the way round the bench. The eyes of the chinless man kept flinting towards the skull-faced man, then turning guiltily away, then being dragged back by an irresistible attraction. Presently, he began to fidget on his seat. At last he stood up, waddled clumsily across the cell, dug down into the pocket of his overalls, and with an abased air held up a grimy piece of bread to the skull-faced man. There was a furious, deafening roar from the telescreen. The chinless man jumped in his tracks. The skull-faced man had quickly thrust his hand behind his back as though demonstrating to all the world that he refused the gift. "Bombstead!" roared the voice. "2713 Bombstead J! Let fall that piece of bread!" The chinless man dropped the piece of bread on the floor. "Remain standing where you are." Oh, my bad. "Remain standing where you are," said the voice. "Face the door. Make no movement." The chinless man obeyed. His large, pouchy cheeks were quivering uncontrollably. The door clanged open. As the young officer entered and stepped aside, there emerged from behind him a short, stumpy guard with enormous arms and shoulders. He took his stand opposite the chinless man, and then at a signal from the officer, let free a frightful blow with all the weight of his body behind it. Full in the chinless man's mouth. Wow. The force of it seemed almost to knock him clear of the floor. His body was flung across the cell and fetched up against the base of the lavatory seat. For a moment, he lay as though stunned, with dark blood oozing from his mouth and nose, a very faint whimpering and squeaking, which seemed unconscious, came out of him. Then he rolled over and raised himself unsteadily on hands and knees. Amid a stream of blood and saliva, the two halves of the dental plate fell out of his mouth. The prisoners sat very still, their hands crossed on their knees. The chinless man climbed back into his place. Down one side of his face, the flesh was darkening. His mouth had swollen into a shapeless cherry-colored mass with a black hole in the middle of it. From time to time, a little blood dripped onto the breast of his overalls. His gray eyes still flitted from face to face, more guiltily than ever, as though he were trying to discover how much the others despised him for his humiliation. The door opened. With a small gesture, the officer indicated the skull-faced man. Room 101, he said. There was a gasp and a flurry at Winston's side. The man had actually flung himself on his knees on the floor with his hands clasped together. Comrade, officer, he cried, you don't have to take me to that place. Haven't I told you everything already? What else is it you want to know? There's nothing. I wouldn't confess. Nothing. Just tell me what it is, and I'll confess straight off. Write it down, and I'll sign it. Anything. Not room 101. Room 101, motherfucker, said the officer. The man's face, already very pale, turned a color Winston would not have believed possible. It was definitely, unmistakably a shade of green. Do anything to me, he yelled. You've been starving me for weeks. Finish it off and let me die. Shoot me, hang me, sentence me to 25 years. Is there somebody else you won't give me to away? You want me to give away? Is there somebody else you want me to give away? Just say who it is, and I'll tell you anything you want. I don't care who it is or what you do to them. I got a wife and three children. The biggest of them isn't 6 years old. You can't take the whole lot of them and cut their throats in front of my eyes, and I'll stand by and watch it, but not room 101. Room 101, motherfucker, said the officer. The man looked frantically round at the other prisoners as though with some idea that he could put another victim in his own place. His eyes settled on the smashed face of the chinless man. He flung out a lean arm. That's the one you ought to be taking, not me, he shouted. You didn't hear what he was saying after they bashed his face. Give me a chance. I'll tell you every word of it. He's the one that's against the party, not me. The guard stepped forward. Oh, my bad. Uh-oh, overacting. The guard stepped forward. The man's voice rose to a shriek. You didn't hear me, he repeated. Something went wrong with the telescreen. He's the one you want. Take him, not me. The two sturdy guards had stooped to take him by the arms, but just at this moment, he flung himself across the floor of the cell and grabbed one of the iron legs that supported the bench. He had set up a wordless howling like an animal. The guard took hold of him to wrench him loose, but he clung on with astonishing strength. For perhaps 20 seconds, they were hauling at him. The prisoners sat quiet, their hands crossed on their knees, looking straight in front of them. The howling stopped. The man had no breath left for anything except hanging on. Then there was a different kind of cry. A kick from a guard's boot had broken the fingers of one of his hands. They dragged him to his feet. Room 101, said the officer. The man was led out, walking unsteadily, with head sunken, nursing his crushed hand. All the fight had gone out of him. A long time passed. If it had been midnight when the skull-faced man was taken away, it was morning. If morning, it was afternoon. Winston was alone and had been alone for hours. The pain of sitting on the narrow bench was such that often that he got up and walked about, unreproved by the telescreen. The piece of bread still lay where the chinless man had dropped it. At the beginning, it needed a hard effort not to look at it, but presently hunger gave away to thirst. His mouth was sticky and evil-tasting. The humming sound and the unvarying white light induced a sort of faintness, an empty feeling inside his head. He would get up because the ache in his bones was no longer bearable, and then would sit down again almost at once because he was too dizzy to make sure of staying on his feet. Whenever his physical sensations were a little under control, the terror returned. Sometimes with a fading hope, he thought of O'Brien and the razor blade. It was thinkable that the razor blade might arrive concealed in his food if he were ever fed. More dimly, he thought of Julia. Somewhere or other, she was suffering perhaps far worse than he. She might be screaming with the pain at this moment, he thought. If I could save Julia by doubling my own pain, would I do it? Yes. Yes, I would. But that was merely an intellectual decision taken because he knew that he ought to take it. He did not feel it. In this place, you could not feel anything except pain and foreknowledge of pain. Besides, was it possible when you were actually suffering it? to wish for any reason that your own pain should increase? But that question was not answerable yet. The booths were approaching again. The door opened. O'Brien came in. I knew O'Brien was going to come in. Anybody knew that O'Brien was going to come through that door? I fucking knew he was going to come through that door. I fucking knew that shit. Babylon, you still alive? This soul.
You know I'm alive. I'm pouring something to drink, but absolutely. I did feel like O'Brien had something to do with it.
I knew he was
going to
come through the door.
I didn't know he was coming through the door, but this is what
I felt.
I felt
he was coming because I felt it when Ambleforth, it was Ambleforth first, and then Parson, and then I was like, you know what I'm saying, O'Brien got to come through that door too.
Now, I'm going to tell you when I was riding with you on it. When you first said it, you said, I wouldn't trust that shit. I can't believe Julia going for this shit. I wouldn't trust them motherfuckers. When they met him in that room?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't have did that shit.
Remember you said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I knew then.
Yeah, exactly. Man, this is all a fuck. I mean, I wouldn't trust none of them motherfuckers. That's why I said, nah, nigga, we'd be on our own. I would have told that nigga, you ain't going to that nigga house. Fuck that nigga.
Yeah.
Fuck your interest. Your curiosity, motherfucker. That's how I roll, Antichrist. Shit. Hell nah, nigga. Hold on. Okay. Give me a minute. I got to grab some water. Hold on. Keep talking, Babylon. I got
talk, Babylon. Need some water.
That's what time it is, though. I wouldn't have trusted that shit, Don. So that's why I knew when you said it in the beginning that you wouldn't trust that shit. I was there already. I was like, damn, I would not go. I would just have to live my life out on the goddamn dolo with me and my chick and just do it that way. And I'd be hell no.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't no way in hell, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You see what them niggas that landed
up there. Crime of other than just fucking and having a relationship that you ain't report to them.
Yeah, that's right. That's
you know
how it would have been.
Yeah, sex crime.
Yeah, that's it.
But these motherfuckers got more. They got sex crime on their ass. They got
bad,
goddamn
bad
conspiracy.
Sense,
they got goddamn. They're a traitor now. They reading that black book, the book. They got a whole bunch of crimes on their ass.
But look what he made them say in that room. Will you kill? Yes. Will you steal? Yes. Will you lie? Yes. So they ain't got no fucking credibility. None.
No morals whatsoever, right?
None. And all of it was recorded.
Okay, where O'Brien? Okay, you ready for O'Brien? Y'all ready for this nigga?
Yeah.
Hey, two, y'all better be up, motherfucker. The booths were approaching again. The door opened. O'Brien came in. Winston started to his feet. The shock of the sight had driven all caution out of him. For the first time in many years, he forgot the presence of the telescreen. They got you too, nigga! He cried. Here go O'Brien with his cool ass. They got me a long time ago, shouted. O'Brien cool as fuck. Like, I think O'Brien is a nigga. I think O'Brien is a nigga, man. I think that's a black man. They got me a long time ago, shouted. With a mild, almost regretful irony, he stepped aside. From behind him, there emerged a broad-chested guard with a long black truncheon in his hand. Truncheon. And he says, you know this, Winston? You know this, Winston, said O'Brien. Don't deceive yourself. You did know it. You have always known it. Yes, he saw now. He had always known it. But there was no time to think of that. All he had eyes for was the truncheon in the guard's hand. It might fall anywhere, on the crown, on the tip of the ear, on the upper arm, on the elbow. The elbow! He had slumped to his knees, almost paralyzed, clasping the stricken elbow with his other hand. Everything had exploded into yellow light. inconceivably that one blow could cause such pain. The light cleared, and he could see the other two looking down at him. The guard was laughing at his contortions. One question at any rate was answered. Never, for any reason on earth, could you wish for an increased pain. Of pain, you could wish only one thing, that it should stop. Nothing in the world was so bad as physical pain. In the face of pain, there was no heroes. No heroes. He thought over and over as he writhed on the floor, clutching uselessly at his disabled left arm. This is fucking good. Is that the end? Let's go to chapter 2. Chapter 2 of part 3. All in favor.
Say what, Donna?
Chapter 2 of part 3. All in favor.
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm playing your ass, nigga. We probably gonna finish. We gonna be through with this book by the end of the night, motherfucker. Won't be no book 1984, nigga. We get to go back to politics next week. All right, here we go. All right, fuck it. Y'all niggas better not go to sleep, man. It's goddamn 3:30 ATL time. Let's go. Y'all niggas better, I'm telling you one thing. Y'all niggas might not go to sleep on this fucking show, but y'all niggas better be up for the Don DeColeone show. That's what the fuck the catch is. All right, here we go. Chapter 2. And don't lie to yourself and say you'll catch the archives in the morning. Don't fucking do that shit to me. You know when a nigga roll up, be like, man, fuck it, man, I can get the archives. Goddamn, shit, I ain't gonna miss it. I can get the archives. Don't even do that shit to me, motherfuckers. Anyway, he was lying on something that felt like a camp bed, except that it was higher off the ground and that he was fixed down in some way so that he could not move. Light that seemed stronger than usual was falling on his face. O'Brien was standing at his side, looking down at him intently. At the other side of him stood a man in a white coat, holding a hypodermic syringe. Even after his eyes were open, he took in his surroundings only gradually. He had the impression of swimming up into this room
Q-U-I-E-T.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I-E-T. Thank you, honey. So it was from some quite different world. A sort of underwater world far beneath it. How long had he been down there? He did not know. Since the moment when they arrested him, he was not seeing darkness or daylight. Besides, his memories were not continuous. There had been times when consciousness, even the sort of consciousness that one has in his sleep, had stopped dead and started again after a blank interval. But whether the intervals were of days or weeks or only seconds, there was no way of knowing. With the first blow on the elbow, the nightmare had started. Later, he was to realize that all that then happened was merely a preliminary, a routine interrogation to which nearly all prisoners were subjected. There was a long range of crimes, espionage, sabotage, and the like, to which everyone had to confess as a matter of course. The confession was a formality, though the torture was real. How many times he had been beaten, how long the beatings had continued, he could not remember. Always there were five or six men in black uniforms at him simultaneously. Sometimes it was the fist. Sometimes it was trunches. Sometimes it was steel rods. Sometimes it was boots. There were times when he rolled about the floor as shameless as an animal, worthing his body this way and that in an endless, hopeless effort to dodge the kicks and simply inventing more and yet more kicks in his ribs, in his belly, on his elbows, on his shins, on his groins, in his testicles, on the bone at the base of his spine. there were times when it went on and on until the cruel, wicked, unforgivable things seemed to him not that the guards continued to beat him, but that he could not force himself into losing consciousness. There were times when his nerves so forsook him that he began shouting for mercy even before the beating began, when the mere sight of a fist drawn back for a blow was enough to make him pour forth a confession of real and imaginary crimes.
Damn.
There were other times when he started out with the resolve of confessing nothing, when every word had to be forced out of him between gaps of pain, and there were times when he feebly tried to compromise, when he said to himself, "I will confess, but not yet. I must hold out till the pain becomes unbearable. Three more kicks, two more kicks, and then I will tell them what they want." Sometimes he was beaten till he could hardly stand, then flung like a sack of potatoes on the stone floor of a cell, left to recuperate for a few hours, and then taken out and beaten again. There were also longer periods of recovery. He remembered them dimly because they were spent chiefly in sleep or stupor. He remembered a cell with a plank bed, a sort of shelf sticking out from the wall, and a tin wash basin, and meals of hot soup and bread and sometimes coffee. He remembered a surly barber arriving to scrape his chin and crop his hair, and businesslike, unsympathetic men in white coats feeling his pulse, tapping his reflexes, turning up his eyelids, running harsh fingers over him in search for broken bones, and shooting needles into his arm to make him sleep. Mm. The beating grew less frequent and became mainly a threat. A horror. You okay? A horror to which he could be sent back at any moment when his answers were unsatisfactory. His questioners now were not ruffians in black uniforms, but party intellectuals. Little rotund men with quick movements and flashing spectacles who worked on him in relays over periods which lasted, he thought, he could not be sure, 10 or 12 hours at a stretch. These other questioners saw to it that he was in a constant slight pain, but it was not chiefly pain that they relied on. They slapped his face, wrung his ears, pulled his hair, made him stand on one leg, refused him to leave to urinate, shone garland lights in his face until his eyes ran with water, But the aim of this was simply to humiliate him and destroy his power of arguing and reasoning. The aim of this was simply to humiliate him and destroy his power of arguing and reasoning. Their real weapon was the merciless questioning that went on and on, hour after hour, tripping him up, laying traps for him, twisting everything that he said, convincing him at every step of lies and self-contradictions until he began weeping as much from shame as from nervous fatigue. Sometimes he would weep half a dozen times in a single session. Most of the time they screamed abuse at him and threatened at every hesitation to deliver him over to the guards again. But sometimes they would suddenly change their tune, call him comrade, appeal to him in the name of Insoc and Big Brother, and ask him sorrowfully whether even now he had not enough loyalty to the party left to make him wish to undo the evil he had done. When his nerves were in rags after hours of questioning, even this appeal could reduce him to sniveling tears. And the end of the nagging voices broke him down more completely than the boots and fists of the guards. He became simply a mouth that uttered, a hand that signed, whatever was demanded of him. His sole concern was to find out what they wanted him to confess and then confess it quickly, before the bullying started anew. He confessed to the assassination of an eminent party member. God damn. The distribution of seditious pamphlets. He confessed to embezzlement of public funds, sale of military secrets, sabotage of every kind. He confessed that he had been a spy in the pay of the East Asian government as far back as 1968. He confessed that he was a religious believer, an admirer of capitalism, and a sexual pervert. He confessed that he had murdered his wife, although he knew, and his questioners must have known, that his wife was still alive. He confessed that for years he had been in a personal touch with Goldstein and had been a member of an underground organization which had included almost every human being he had ever known. It was easier to confess everything and implicate everybody. Besides, in a sense, it was all true. It was true that he had been the enemy of the party. And in the eyes of the party, there was no distinction between the thought and the deed. There were also memories of another kind. They stood out in his mind disconnectedly, like pictures with blackness all around them. He was in a cell, which might have been either dark or light, because he could see nothing except a pair of eyes. Near at hand, some kind of instrument was ticking slowly and regularly. The eyes grew larger and more luminous. Suddenly, he floated out of his seat, dived into the eyes, and was swallowed up. He was strapped into a chair surrounded by dials. Under dazzling lights, a man in a white coat was reading the dials. There was a tramp of heavy boots outside. The door clanged open. The wax-faced officer marched in, followed by two guards. Room 101, said the officer. The man in the white coat did not turn around. He did not look at Winston either. He was looking only at the dials. He was rolling down a mighty corridor, a kilometer wide, full of glorious golden light, roaring with laughter and shouting out confessions at the top of his voice. He was confessing everything, even the things he had succeeded in holding back under the torture. He was relating the entire history of his life to an audience who already knew it. With him were the guards, the other questioners, the men, the white coats, O'Brien, Julia, Mr. Charrington, all rolling down the corridor together, shouting with laughter. Some dreadful thing which had lain embedded in the future had somehow been skipped over and had not happened. Everything was all right. There was no more pain. The last detail of his life was laid bare, understood, forgiven. He was staring up from the plank bed in the half certainty that he had heard O'Brien's voice. All through his interrogation, although he had never seen him, he had had the feeling that O'Brien was at his elbow, just out of sight. It was O'Brien who was directing everything. It was he who set the guards onto Winston and who prevented them from killing him. It was he who decided when Winston should scream with pain, when he should have a respite, when he should be fed, when he should sleep, when the drug should be pumped into his arm. It was he who asked the questions and suggested the answers. He was the tormentor. He was the protector. He was the inquisitor. He was the friend. And once Winston could not remember whether it was in drugs sleep or in normal sleep or even in a moment of wakefulness. A voice murmured in his ear, "Don't worry, Winston. You are in my keeping. For 7 years I have watched over you. Now the turning point has come. I shall save you. I shall make you perfect." He was not sure whether it was O'Brien's voice, but it was the same voice that had said to him, "We shall meet in the place where there is no darkness," in that other dream 7 years ago. This shit good as fuck, yo. Yeah. He did not remember any ending to his interrogation. There was a period of blackness and then the cell or room in which he now was had gradually materialized round him. He was almost flat on his back and unable to move. His body was held down at every essential point. Even the back of his head was gripped in some manner. O'Brien was looking down at him gravely and rather sadly. His face seen from below, look coarse and worn, with pouches under the eyes and tired lines from nose to chin. He was older than Winston had thought him. He was perhaps 48 or 50. Under his hand, there was a dial with a lever on top and figures running round the face. I told you, said O'Brien, that if we meet again, it would be here. Yes, said Winston. Without any warning, except a slight movement of O'Brien's hand, a wave of pain flooded his body. It was a frightening pain because he could not see what was happening, and he had the feeling that some mortal injury was being done to him. He did not know whether the thing was really happening or whether the effect was electrically produced, but his body was being wrenched out of shape. The joints were being slowly torn apart. Although the pain had brought the sweat out of his forehead, out on his forehead, the worst of all was the fear that his backbone was about to snap. He set his teeth, and he breathed hard through his nose, trying to keep silent as long as possible. You are afraid, said O'Brien, watching his face. You are afraid that in another moment something is going to break. Your especial fear is that it will be your backbone. You have a vivid mental picture of the vertebrae snapping apart and the spinal fluid dripping out of them. That is what you are thinking. Is it not, Winston? Winston did not answer. He about to go through that surgery shit, ain't he, Babylon?
This is MK Ultra at its finest. This is Project Paperclip. This is Mengelev, the whole Jewish German scientist that was transported over to Oceania, known as America. This is the whole goddamn thing. They are giving you what the government does to certain people. Or giving us, you know, that's what this book is
about.
So
you don't think he about to get a face transplant and all that shit O'Brien was talking about?
I don't know. I don't know, because I thought I heard you say Julia was in the hallway laughing.
Yeah, man, like, and that wasn't sad. It was saying everybody was going to have laughing and shit.
So it took a twist on me. I swear, Don, I ain't never read the book. I only read ahead, so I don't know what the fuck is going to go on. But I know it's some good shit. And I'm sitting here like, why? I don't know why she think I'm fucking asleep. I'm sitting here like, damn. So this is, I'm wishing I could talk the whole while. But he getting Mengelev, Don. Mengelev is the name of a Jewish German scientist who was in Port of Hill. They call him the Mengele. They call him the Death, Dr. Death. And this nigga took them niggas through all type of shit. He invented that Monarch programming, MK Ultra, all that shit, like that. Delta Force. All that shit, 5 hours that he was talking about. Fucking, you know. But yeah, there's some good shit. I'm ready, Don.
Okay. Thank you, Babylon, dude. You ain't even fucking reading. This is good.
Nah,
it gotta be
listening.
That good, your ass ain't reading.
Yeah. I'm sitting right here.
Thank you, Babylon. Okay.
You already
Winston
know
did not answer. O'Brien drew back the lever on the dial. The wave of pain receded almost as quickly as it had come. That was 40, said O'Brien. You can see that the numbers on the dial run up to 100. Will you please remember throughout our conversation that I have it in my power to inflict pain on you at any moment and to whatever degree I choose. If you tell me any lies or attempt to prevaricate in any way, or even fall below your usual level of intelligence, you will cry out with pain instantly. Do you understand that? Yes, said Winston.
Done.
O'Brien's
can I
manner.
Say one thing?
What?
Let me say one thing. More
is
so
he electrocuting that nigga? Like putting that shock treatment on his ass?
Shock treatment, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right, torture. So more so than trying to punish him for his crimes, because that's already out the way. He already in their power. This is an experiment, and you brought it up just the other day that they said that they was going to take the gays and do experiments on them. They signed a bill.
Yeah, the
that
sex predators
homosexual,
or whatever you call them. Yeah.
Sexual predators and fucking do tests and experiments on them. So this is the type of shit that they're doing. They trying to see what it takes to break a human being, to enter a human being's brain, to take over the human being's mind. They already got everything down pat with InSoc, controlling the paper, the media, and all that shit. But they want to know how people's brains work.
Okay, here we go. So Winston says yes. O'Brien's manner became less severe. He resettled his spectacles thoughtfully and took a pace or two up and down. When he spoke, his voice was gentle and patient. He had the air of a doctor, a teacher, even a priest, anxious to explain and persuade rather than to punish. I am taking trouble with you, Winston, because you are worth trouble. You know perfectly well what is the matter with you. You have known it for years, though you have fought against the knowledge. You are mentally deranged. You suffer from a defective memory. You are unable to remember real events, and you persuade yourself that you remember other events which never happened. Fortunately, it is curable. You're right, right. Be some MK Ultra shit, huh? You have never cured yourself of it because you did not choose to. There was a small effort of the will that you were not ready to make. Even now, I am well aware you are clinging to your disease under the impression that it is a virtue. Now, we will take an example. At this moment, which power is Oceana at war? At this moment, which power is Oceana at war with? Uh-oh. And what was the answer? What's supposed to be the answer?
East Asia. They switched it from Eurasia to East Asia.
Okay, here it goes. Oh, is he still talking? No. Okay, I think this is Winston now. When I was arrested, Oceana was at war with East Asia. With East Asia. Good. And Oceana has always been at war with East Asia, has it not? Winston drew in his breath. He opened his mouth to speak and then did not speak. He could not take his eyes away from the dial. The truth, please, Winston, your truth. Tell me what you think you remember. I remember that until, oh, I should be like I'm in pain, right? I remember that until only a week before I was arrested. We were not at war with East Asia at all. We were in alliance with them. The war was against Eurasia. That had lasted for 4 years. Before that, O'Brien stopped him with the movement of the hand. O'Brien stopped him with the movement of the hand. And you know why? I get it now. Isn't this motherfucker do all the goddamn copy, cut, snip prints of the work he do? Wouldn't he fucking know the truth?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. O'Brien stopped him with the movement of a hand. Hey, G, another example, he said. Some years ago, you had a very serious delusion indeed. You believed that three one-time party members named Jones, Arison, and Rutherford, men who were executed for treachery and sabotage after making the fullest possible confession, were not guilty of the crimes they were charged with. You believed that you had unmistakable documentary evidence proving that their confessions were false. There was a certain photograph about which you had a hallucination. You believed that you had actually held it in your hands. It was a photograph, something like this. Oh, shit! A oblong slip of newspaper had appeared between O'Brien's fingers. For perhaps 5 seconds, it was within the angle of Winston's vision. It was a photograph, and there was no question of its identity. It was the photograph. It was another copy of the photograph of Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford at the party function in New York, which he had chanced upon 11 years ago and promptly destroyed. For only an instant, it was before his eyes. Then it was out of sight again. But he had seen it. Unquestionably, he had seen it. He made a desperate, agonizing effort to wrench the top half of his body free. it was impossible to move so. It was impossible to move so much as a centimeter in any direction. For the moment he had forgotten the dial, all he wanted was to hold the photograph in his fingers again, or at least to see it. "It exists," he cried. "No," said O'Brien. He stepped across the room. There was a memory hole in the opposite wall. O'Brien lifted the grafting. Unseen, the frail slip of paper was whirling away on the current of a warm air. It was vanishing in a flash of flame. O'Brien turned away from the wall. "Ashes," he said. "Not even identifiable ashes. Dust. It does not exist. It never existed." "But it did exist. It does exist. It exists in your memory. It exists in memory. I remember it. You remember it." "I do not remember it," said O'Brien. Winston's heart sank. That was devil think. you want me to repeat what O'Brien said again?
Yeah, that was hot.
Yeah, okay. O'Brien says, "Ashes. Not even identifiable ashes. Dust. It does not exist. It never existed. But it did exist. It does exist. It exists in memory. I remember it. You remember it. I do not remember it," said O'Brien.
That's right.
Then Winston's heart sank and said, "That was double think. That was certainly double think." He had a feeling of deadly helplessness. If he could have been certain that O'Brien was lying, it would not have seemed to matter. But it was perfectly possible that O'Brien had really forgotten the photograph. And if so, then already he would have forgotten his denial of remembering it and forgotten the act of forgetting. He could only be sure that it was simple trickery. Oh, I'm sorry. How could one be sure that it was simple trickery? Perhaps the lunatic dislocation in the mind could really happen. This was the thought that defeated him. O'Brien was looking down at him speculatively. More than ever, he had the air of a teacher taking pains with a wayward but promising child. "There is a party slogan dealing with the control of the past," he said. "Repeat it, if you please." Repeat after me, Babylon. Who controls the past controls the future.
Who controls the past controls the future.
Who controls the present controls the past.
Who controls the present controls the past.
Good job. Nodding his head with slow approval, O'Brien, of course, "It is your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence." No, "Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence?" Again, the feeling of helplessness descended upon Winston. His eyes flitted towards the dial. He not only did not know whether yes or no was the answer that would save him from pain, he did not even know which answer he believed to be the true one. O'Brien smiled faintly. "You are no metaphysician, Winston," he said. "Until this moment, you had never considered what it meant. Until this moment, you had never considered what is meant by existence. I will put it more precisely. Does the past exist concretely in space? Is there somewhere or other a place, a world of solid objects where the past is still happening? No. Then where does the past exist, if at all? In records, it is written down. In records and in the mind, in human memories, in memory. Very well, then. We, the party, control all records, and we control all memories. Then we control the past, do we not?"
"The official records."
"You already fucking know. But how can you stop people remembering? Oh, here's go Winston. But how can you stop people remembering things? cried Winston, again momentarily forgetting the dial. It is voluntary. It is outside oneself. How can you control memory? You have not controlled mine. That's how they go. You have not controlled mine. O'Brien's manner grew stern again. He laid his hand on the dial. On the contrary, he said, you have not controlled it. Woo-hoo! That was a bad answer, right? A bad rebuttal. You have not controlled it. That is what. Then what did he say? He said, you have not controlled it. That is what has brought you here. You are here because you have failed in humility and self-discipline. You would not make the act of submission, which is the price of sanity. You prefer to be a lunatic, a minority of one. Only the disciplined mind can see reality, Winston. You believe that reality is something objective, external, existing in its own right. You also believe that the nature of reality is self-evident. When you delude yourself into thinking that you see something, you assume that everyone else sees the same thing as you. But I tell you, Winston, that reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. Not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes, and in any case, soon perishes. Only in the mind of the party, which is collective and immortal. Whatever the party holds to be the truth is truth. It is impossible to see reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact that you have got to relearn, Winston. It needs an act of self-destruction, an effort of the will. You must humble yourself before you can become sane. Whoa.
Oh, you MK Ultra, Don.
He paused for a few moments, as though to allow what he had been saying to sink in. Do you remember? Writing on your diary, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. Yes, said Winston. O'Brien held up his left hand, his back towards Winston, with the thumb hidden and the four fingers extended. How many fingers am I holding up, Winston? 4. And if the party says that it is not 4, but 5, then how many? 4. The word ended in a gasp of pain. The needle of the dial had shot up to 55.
That's good with stupid ass.
Exactly, man. The sweat has sprung out all over Winston's body. The air tore into his lungs and issued again in deep groans, which even by clenching his teeth, he could not stop. O'Brien watched him, the four fingers still extended. He drew back the lever. This time the pain was only slightly eased. How many fingers, Winston? 4. The needle went up to 60. How many fingers, Winston? 4! What else can I say? 4! The needle must have risen again, but did not look at it. But he did not look at it. The heavy, stern face and the four fingers filled his vision. The fingers stood up before his eyes like pillars, enormous, blurry, and seeming to vibrate, but unmistakably 4. How many fingers, Winston? 4! Stop it! Stop it! How can you go on? 4, motherfucker!
Damn.
How many fingers, Winston? 5! No, Winston. That is no use. You are lying. You still think there are four. How many fingers? Please. Four, five, four. Anything you like, motherfucker. Only stop it. Stop the goddamn pain. Abruptly, he was sitting up with O'Brien's arm round his shoulders. He had perhaps lost consciousness for a few seconds. The bonds that had held his body down were loosened. He felt very cold. He was shaking uncontrollably. His teeth were chattering. The tears were rolling down his cheeks. For a moment, he clung to O'Brien's like a baby, curiously comforted by the heavy arm round his shoulders. He had the feeling that O'Brien was his protector, that the pain was something that came from outside, from some other source, and that it was O'Brien who would save him from it.
Stockholm.
You are a slow learner, Winston, said O'Brien gently. How can I help it, he blubbered. How can I help seeing what is in front of my eyes? Two and two are four. Sometimes, Winston, sometimes they are five. Sometimes they are three. Sometimes they are all of them at once. You must try harder. It is not easy to become sane. This is what the fuck? Let me rewind that part.
Exactly.
Okay, wait. You are a slow learner, Winston, said O'Brien gently. How can I help it, he blubbered. How can I help seeing what is in front of my eyes? Two and two are four. Okay. They don't let you know that O'Brien is talking. Anyway, so this has got to be O'Brien, of course. Sometimes, Winston, sometimes they are five. Sometimes they are three. Sometimes they are all of them at once. You must try harder. It is not easy to become sane. This is deep. He laid Winston down on the bed, the grip of his limbs tightened again, but the pain had embedded away, and the trembling had stopped, leaving him merely weak and cold. O'Brien motioned with his head to the man in the white coat, who had stood immobile throughout the proceedings. The man in the white coat bent down and looked closely into Winston's eyes, felt his pulse, laid an ear against his chest, tapped here and there, and then he nodded to O'Brien. Again, said O'Brien. The pain flowed into Winston's body. The needle must be at 70, 75. He had shut his eyes this time. He knew that the fingers were still there, and still four. All that mattered was somehow to stay alive until the spasm was over. He had ceased to notice whether he was crying out or not pain. The pain lessened again. He opened his eyes. O'Brien had drawn back the lever. How many fingers, Winston? Four. I suppose there are four. I would see five if I could. I'm trying to see five. Which do you wish? I think this is him. I'm sorry. I think he's still talking. I don't know who's talking here, though. Which do you wish?
When?
To persuade me when? That you see five? Okay, this is O'Brien talking.
Okay.
Which do you wish? To persuade me that you see five? Or really to see them? Really to see them? Again, said O'Brien. Perhaps the needle was 80, 90. Winston could not intermittently remember why the pain was happening. Behind his screwed-up eyelids, a forest of fingers seemed to be moving in a sort of a dance, weaving in and out, disappearing behind one another and reappearing again. He was trying to count them. He could not remember why. He knew only that it was impossible to count them and that this was somehow due to the mysterious identity between five and four. The pain died down again. When he opened his eyes, it was to find that he was still seeing the same thing. innumerable fingers, like moving trees, were still streaming past in either direction, crossing and recrossing. He shut his eyes again. How many fingers am I holding up, Winston? I don't know. I don't know. You will kill me if you do that again. 4, 5, 6, in all honesty, I don't know. Better. Better, said O'Brien. Better. A needle slid into Winston's arm. Almost in the same instant, a blissful, healing warmth spread all through his body. The pain was already half forgotten. He opened his eyes and looked up gratefully at O'Brien. At sight of the heavy, lined face, so ugly and so intelligent, his heart seemed to turn over. If he could have moved, he would have stretched out a hand and laid it on O'Brien's arm. He had never loved him so deeply as at this moment, and not merely because he had stopped the pain. The old feeling that at the bottom, it did not matter whether O'Brien was a friend or an enemy, had come back. O'Brien was a person who could be talked to. Perhaps one did not want to be loved so much as to be understood. Perhaps one did not want to be loved so much. No. Perhaps, no, put my shit down. Perhaps one did not want to be loved so much as to be understood. O'Brien had tortured him to the edge of lunacy, and in a little while, it was certain he would send him to his death. It made no difference. In some sense, that went deeper than friendship. They were intimates. They were intimates. How about that? Intimates, intimates. They were intimates. Yeah. Somewhere or other, although the actual words might never be spoken, there was a place where they could meet and talk. O'Brien was looking down at him with an expression which suggested that the same thought might be in his own mind. When he spoke, it was in an easy conversational tone. Do you know where you are, Winston? He said. I don't know. I could guess in the Ministry of Love. Do you know how long you have been here? I don't know. Days, weeks, months. I think it is months. And why do you imagine that we bring people to this place? To make them confess. No, that is not the reason. Try again. To punish them. No, exclaimed O'Brien. His voice had changed extraordinarily, and his face had suddenly become both stern and animated. No, not merely to extract your confession. Not to punish you. Shall I tell you why we have brought you here? To cure you. To make you sane, motherfucker. Mm. Will you understand, Winston, that no one whom we bring to this place ever leaves our hands uncured? We are not interested in those stupid crimes that you have committed. The party is not interested in the overt act. The thought is all we care about. The thought is all we care about. We do not merely destroy our enemies. We change them. Do you understand what I mean by that? God damn.
Done. Listen. Now, you know what I see, though? That you know how Winston say his wife died, right? Suppose Winston already done been through this brain fucking washing, brain pollution before, this whole system before. And when he came out, he didn't even remember his wife or none of that shit.
He already been through it. Yeah.
And then this
again,
because
he keep having,
around.
What you call that shit, he keep getting glimpses like a total recall, and now they got to put it there.
That's right.
Again.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see. That's why they keep able to keep the in-stock shit going, keep them on them remedial dumbass jobs and shit, because they be done been through that shit before. That's crazy.
Man, this shit is fucking strong, nigga.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. He asked, do you understand what I mean by that, Winston? Wow! He was bending over Winston. His face looked enormous because of its nearness and hideously ugly because it was seen from below. Moreover, it was filled with a sort of exaltation, a lunatic intensity. Again, Winston's heart shrank. If it had been possible, he would have cowered deeper into the bed. He felt certain that O'Brien was about to twist the dial out of sheer wantonness. At this moment, however, O'Brien turned away. He took a pace or two up and down. Then he continued less vehemently. The first thing for you to understand is that in this place, there are no martyrdoms. You have read of the religious persecutions of the past. In the Middle Ages, there was the Inquisition. It was a failure. It set out to eradicate heresy and ended by perpetuating it. For every heretic, it burned at the stake. Thousands of others rose up. Why was that? Because the Inquisition killed its enemies in the open and killed them while they were still unrepentant. In fact, it killed them because they were unrepentant. Men were dying because they would not abandon their true beliefs. Naturally, all the glory belonged to the victim and all the shame to the inquisitor who burned them. Later, in the 20th century, there were the totalitarians, as they were called. They were the German Nazis and the Russian communists. The Russians persecuted heresy more cruelly than the Inquisition had done. And they imagined that they had learned from the mistakes of the past. They knew, at any rate, that one must not make martyrs. Before they exposed their victims to public trial, they deliberately set themselves to destroy their dignity. They wore them down by torture and solitude until they were despicable, cringing wretches, confessing whatever was put into their mouth, covering themselves with abuse, accusing and sheltering behind one another, whimpering for mercy. And yet, after only a few years, the same thing had happened over again. The dead men had become martyrs, and their degradation was forgotten. Once again, why was it? In the first place, because the confessions that they had made were obviously extorted and untrue. We do not make mistakes of that kind. All the confessions that are uttered here are true. We make them true. And above all, we do not allow the dead to rise up against us. You must stop imagining that posterity will vindicate you, Winston. Posterity will never hear of you. You will be lifted clean out from the stream of history. We shall turn you into gas and pour you into the stratosphere. Nothing will remain of you, not a name in a register, not a memory in a living brain. You will be annihilated in the past as well as in the future. You will never have existed. Then why bother to torture me? Thought Winston with a momentary bitterness. O'Brien checked his step as though Winston had uttered the thought aloud. His large, ugly face came nearer with the eyes a little narrowed. You are thinking, he said, you are thinking that since we intend to destroy you utterly so that nothing that you say or do can make the smallest difference, in that case, why do we go to the trouble of interrogating you first? That is why you are thinking, was it not? Yes, said Winston. O'Brien smiled slightly. You are a flaw in the pattern, Winston. You are a stain that must be wiped out. Did I not tell you just now that we are different from the persecutors of the past? We are not content with negative obedience, nor even with the most abject submission. When finally you surrender to us, it must be of your own free will. We do not destroy the heretic because he resists us. so long as he resists us, we destroy him. We convert him. We capture him, his inner mind. We reshape him. We burn all evil and all illusion out of him. We bring him over to our side, not in appearance, but genuinely, heart and soul. We make him one of ourselves before we kill him. It is intolerable to us that an erroneous thought should exist anywhere in the world, however secret and powerless it may be. Even in the instant of death, we cannot permit any deviation. In the old days, the heretic walked to the stake, still a heretic, proclaiming his heresy, exulting in it. Even the victim of the Russian purges could carry rebellion locked up in his skull as he walked down the passage waiting for the bullet. But we make the brain perfect before we blow it out. The command of the old despotism was, thou shalt not. The command of the totalitarians was, thou shalt. Our command is, thou art. No one whom we bring to this place ever stands out against us. Everyone is washed clean, even those three miserable traitors in whose innocence you once believed, Jones, Harrison, and Rutherford. In the end, we broke them down. I took part in their interrogation myself. I saw them gradually worn down, whimpering, groveling, weeping. And in the end, it was not with pain or fear, only with penitence. By the time we had finished with them, they were only the shells of men. They were nothing. There was nothing left in them except sorrow for what they had done and love of Big Brother. It was touching to see how they loved him. They begged to be shot quickly so that they could die while their minds were still clean. His voice had grown almost dreamy. I think that was good there. His voice had grown almost dreamy. The exaltation, the lunatic enthusiasm was still in his face. He is not pretending, thought Winston. He is not a fucking hypocrite. He believes every word he says. Yeah. What most oppressed him was the consciousness of his own intellectual inferiority. He watched the heavy yet graceful form strolling to and fro in and out of the range of his vision. O'Brien was a being in all ways larger than himself. There was no idea that he had ever had or could have that O'Brien had not long ago known, examined, and rejected. His mind contained Winston's mind. But in that case, how could it be true that O'Brien was mad? It must be he, Winston, who was mad. O'Brien halted and looked down at him. His voice had grown stern again. Do not imagine that you will save yourself, Winston, however completely you surrender to us. No one who has once gone astray is ever spared. And even if we choose to let you live, nigga, out of the natural term of your life, still, you would never escape from us. What happens to you here is forever. Understand that in advance. We shall crush you down to the point from which there is no coming back. Things will happen to your motherfucking ass from which you could not recover if you live 1,000 years. Like, I fucking looked at the chat room. I should have even looked at like, I got distracted. That was good. Wait. Okay, wait. Wait, where am I at? 1,000 years. Neither again, never again will you be capable of ordinary human feeling. Everything will be dead inside you. Never again will you be capable of love or friendship or joy of living or laughter or curiosity or courage or integrity. You will be hollow, motherfucker. We will squeeze you empty, and then we shall fill you with ourselves. God damn! He paused and signed to the man in the white coat. Winston was aware of some heavy piece of apparatus being pushed into place behind his head. O'Brien had sat down beside the bed so that his face was almost on a level with Winston's. 3,000, he said, speaking over Winston's head to the man in the white coat. Two soft pads, which felt slightly moist, clamped themselves against Winston's temples. He quailed. There was pain coming, a new kind of pain. O'Brien laid a hand, reassuring, almost kindly, on his. This time, it would not hurt. Keep your eyes fixed on mine, said O'Brien. At this moment, there was a devastating explosion, or what seemed like an explosion, though it was not certain whether there was any noise. There was undoubtedly a blinding flash of light. Winston was not hurt, only prostrated. Although he had already been lying on his back when the thing happened, he had a curious feeling that he had been knocked into that position. A terrific, painless blow had flattened him out. Also, something had happened inside his head. As his eyes regained focus, he remembered who he was and where he was, and recognized the face that was gazing into his own. But somewhere or other, there was a large patch of emptiness, as though a piece had been taken out of his brain. They did. They took some shit out of his brain? O'Brien says.
I guess so,
Don. I don't fucking know what that loud explosion was. O'Brien says, it will not last. Look me in the eyes. What country is Oceania at war with? Winston thought. He knew what was meant by Oceania and that he himself was a citizen of Oceania. He also remembered Eurasia and East Asia, but who was at war with whom, he did not know. In fact, he had not been aware that there was any war. I don't remember. Oceania is at war with East Asia. Do you remember that now? Yes. Oceania has always been at war with East Asia, the beginning of your life, since the beginning of the party, since the beginning of history. The war has continued without a break, always the same war. Do you remember that? Yes. 11 years ago, you created a legend about three men who had been condemned to death for treachery. You pretended that you had seen a piece of paper which proved them innocent. No such piece of paper ever existed. You invented it, and later you grew to believe in it. You remember now the very moment at which you first invented it. Do you remember that? Yes. Just now, I held up the fingers of my hand to you. You saw five fingers. Do you remember that? Yes. O'Brien held up the fingers of his left hand with the thumb concealed. There are five fingers there. Do you see five fingers? Yes. And he did see them for a fleeting instant before the scenery of his mind changed. He saw five fingers, and there was no deformity. Then, damn, he had his thumbs concealed, though. This nigga see five fingers, and nigga was holding up four. That's some deep-ass shit. Oh, my Lord, it'll put that nigga back to sleep.
Absolutely.
Then everything was normal again. An old fear, the hatred, and the bewilderment came crowding back again. But there had been a moment. He had not know how long, 30 seconds perhaps, of luminous certainty, which each new suggestion of O'Brien's had filled up a patch of emptiness and became absolute truth. And when two and two could have been three as easily as five, if that were what was needed, it had faded out before O'Brien had dropped his hand. But though he could not recapture it, he could remember it, as one remembers a vivid experience at some period of one's life when one was in effect a different person. You see now, said O'Brien, you see now that it is at any rate possible. Yes, said Winston. This shit is crazy, ain't it?
Yeah.
O'Brien stood up with a satisfied air. Over to his left, Winston saw the man in the white coat break in ample and draw back the plunger of a syringe. O'Brien turned to Winston with a smile. In almost the old manner, he resettled his spectacles on his nose. Do you remember writing in your diary that it did not matter whether I was a friend or an enemy, since I was at least a person who understood you and could be talked to? You were right. I enjoy talking to you. Your mind appeals to me. It resembles my own mind, except that you happen to be insane. Before we bring the session to an end, you can ask me a few questions if you choose. Ooh, okay, 5 minutes to overtime. Thank you, Neff. All right, y'all got to call in and hurry up so we can finish this end of this little chapter. Call in. 347-884-9255. Okay, here we go. All right, you can ask me any question if you choose. Any question. He said, any question I like, anything. He saw that Winston's eyes were upon the dial. It switched off. It switched off. What is your first question? What have you done with Julia? Said Winston. O'Brien smiled again. She betrayed you, Winston.
Where that, Don?
He asked about Julia. What have you done with Julia? Then it said, O'Brien smiled again and said, she betrayed you, Winston. Immediately, unreservedly. I have seldom seen anyone come over to us so promptly. You would hardly recognize her if you saw her. All her rebelliousness, her deceit, her folly, her dirty-mindedness, everything has been burned out of her. It was a perfect conversion, a textbook case. You tortured her? O'Brien left this unanswered. Next question, he said. Does Big Brother exist? Of course he exists. The party exists. Big Brother is the embodiment of the party. Does he exist in the same way as I exist? Winston asks, does he exist in the same way I exist? O'Brien says, you do not exist. Once again, he's still talking. No. Oh, yeah, once again, the sense of helplessness assailed him. He knew, or he could imagine, the arguments which proved his own non-existence. But they were nonsense. They were only a play on words. Did not, the statement, you do not exist, contain a logical absurdity. Oh, my bad. Did not, the statement, you did not exist, contain a logical absurdity, but what use was it to say so? His mind shriveled as he thought of the unanswerable, mad arguments with which O'Brien would demolish him. I think I exist, he said wearily. I am conscious of my own identity. I was born and I shall die. I have arms and legs. I occupy a particular point in space. No other solid object can occupy the same point simultaneously in that sense. Does Big Brother exist? It is of no importance. He exists. Will Big Brother ever die? Of course not. How could he die? Next question. Does the Brotherhood exist? That, Winston, you will never know. If we choose to set you free, when we have finished with you, and if you live to be 90 years old, still you will never learn whether the answer to that question is yes or no. As long as you live, it will be unsolved riddle in your mind. Winston lay silent, his breast rose and fell a little faster. He still not asked the question that had come into his mind the first. He had got to ask it, and yet it was as though his tongue would not utter it. There was a trace of amusement in O'Brien's face. Even his spectacles seemed to wear an ironical gleam. He knows, thought Winston suddenly. He knows what I am going to ask. At the thought, the words burst out of him. What is room 101? The expression on... Okay, 90 seconds, we're going to overtime. The expression on O'Brien's face did not change. He answered drily. You know what is room 101, Winston. Everyone knows what is in room 101. He raised a finger to the man in the white coat. Evidently, the session was at an end. A needle jerked into Winston's arm. He sank almost instantly into a deep sleep. And that's the end. And we'll wait on next week for chapter 3. That's the end. So now we got to know what the fuck is 101. That was good.
Yeah.
Okay, Babylon, you still alive? Thank you now.
Yeah.
Anybody on the call lines that's still up? Push
one,
honey. Huh?
Oh, I said, I know you can hear me. You talking about Babylon, you still alive. I said, I know you can hear me.
I'm still up. I'm just listening in.
Okay, we done now, honey.
What up, man?
You know what I'm saying. I've been here the whole time, though. It was great, Don. It was a great oration.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Put that on record.
Mother. I'm going to keep going.
Leave the suspense, Don.
You know when the cat is away, you know what happens.
Yeah. It was good, all though.
Right. Yeah, man. All right. So we'll be patient for next week, right, Cedar? Okay.
Yeah.
Damn, that shit was good. God damn.
I know they done twisted his fucking mind.
I know.
That's some crazy shit. 1, 2, 3.
Wow. This is some deep-ass shit. Oh, my God. I see why people read books and watch the movies.
Yeah.
Make you smarter.
I knew they had a higher purpose than just punishing him, though. I knew that. I could tell. I knew it was deeper than that. Than just go to jail and get your ass beat and go all that money and expense they going through, doctors and shit. Nah, they about to do some mind work on their ass.
That nigga all that shit. They the good guy and the bad God and the devil.
Yeah.
That's some incredible shit. They're the revolutionists and the goddamn oppressioner.
Yeah.
This nigga, they
that's
playing both goddamn sides, my nigga. Come on in, ISIS or Tahuti, or both. Where y'all at? Give me a mic check.
Mic check.
Hey, honey. Oh, my God. Y'all still hanging with hot damn politics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Y'all got that shit, man. Did y'all enjoy that shit?
I'm enjoying it, Don.
Yeah, you drink.
Yes, she did.
Oh, my God, that shit was good, man. We should cheat. This is chapter 3, y'all think. We should cheat, man. Anyway, J1 said, hey, I said, and DJ Peanut Butter.
Hey, J1.
What?
Yeah, what's hey, up, Tahuti? What's up, I said?
Hey, Babylon. Trying to make these center rolls now. You done got a nigga up wanting to eat.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, after that one.
I know it. Goddamn, J1 said she put some chicken in the fucking oven. It's goddamn 4 fucking 30 to goddamn all this shit. This shit is so fucking good, man. I'm gonna stop. Like, this is goddamn good.
I heard that.
We got a long way to go, though.
I wouldn't have never even thought to even read a book, you know, like that. That's something I would have passed up. But
only fire line is honey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Be bringing good food to the table, man.
Yeah.
Damn, this is some good ass shit here, man. Niggas missing out on this shit. 1980, motherfucking foe.
Yeah.
That shit is a shit. Huh?
So I said, what made you pick up a book titled that, just saying 1984?
Fireline said she read it when she was 16. I think when she was 16.
Yeah, so well, that.
That shit was futuristic. That's why.
Yeah, because when she was 16, it damn sure won 1984.
Right. They said this book was written in 48, opposite of 84. So it was some real futuristic shit. So I can see why they would pick it up.
I can see why Fireline is picking it up. I wouldn't know why anybody else would. But, you know, they kept mentioning 1984. If you Google 1984, you'll see Obama and all them niggas pop up in articles in conjunction with the book 1984. You'll see Obama
see
in conjunction with the book 1984.
Right.
They're making statements and articles that could this be the 1984 that, what's his name, George or whatever his name?
George Orwell.
Yeah, was talking about in regards to Obama and all and what the fuck is going on now.
It's probably been 50 years in the making.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah, now.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let y'all get y'all rest. And I got to plug up Don Nicoleon so she could be charged up for tomorrow for her show. I got to put her ass do me a favor, unplug that so we can plug up Don and charge her up. Put a Sanana shell a bird at me. Sanana, please unplug that and get the other battery. We gotta put another battery in Don back, goddammit.
Surrogate, man. I want me a surrogate.
You want a surrogate, Babylon?
Damn right.
Oh, honey, you have to be wealthy to be a surrogate.
I know, like myself.
You know, you can create your own surrogate, though, like I did.
Nah, that motherfucker be cheap and dumb as hell.
I got a few surrogates in the closet back there in the store. I don't let nobody go back and just go back there. Fuck around and see three of me goddamn charged up against the wall and shit. It's just scary.
Yeah, you're right. That's going to be crazy. I get the fuck up out of here, boy.
What fucking sick shit is this?
What matter of shit is this? I don't know who the fuck this is.
Okay. All right, well, y'all get y'all rest, man. Let me see, 4:30. Cena, don't leave yet. Let me see, 4:30. Let me see, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. All right, I bet you my children want me to take their ass home, too. You see this shit? Okay, y'all, we up out of here, man. And, of course, I still got the mic in the after party. Babylon, you done, honey. Get your rest, honey. And so, and
I'm not tired.
You sound tired. We should all stay up, man, and do another fucking show and all the way to 12. All in favor. This should be good as fuck. Look at J-1. We should. This is how we do it in the after party, though, Babylon. This is nothing for us, son. This is nothing. This is nothing for us. This is easy. I got another surrogate already charged up anyway. So I can put this one and charge this one up and put a battery in this one.
We got plenty of days be up to the sun come up.
Yeah.
On both coasts. Yeah.
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 Oh, now I'll be glad when you get your body back. Mama Wattie done cursed you.
Me too.
Stop.
Yeah, we read up on Mama Wassey. That bitch is a punishment. The bitch disfigure people.
Yeah.
There's a curse from Mama Wassey. Pregnant. That's in chapter 9, I think, that we read about the lady. The lady that always kept singing with the clothesline, and then Winston noticed how beautiful she was, but then just saw how her body must have been perfect at one point, then got so big and so tight and so this, because the bitch is pregnant, had so many goddamn kids, and now she a grandmama.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it said. Her whole body just got fucked up, but it still looked good. That type of shit.
Wow.
Yeah, all I saw was my grandmother that he was picturing. Yeah. Say what? All right, start the club, baby. All right, let me take my baby's home because I got to pick their ass up in 12 hours from now. 4 a.m., I got to pick their ass back up at 4 p.m. This is some bullshit.
Hey, son. Be safe.
All right. I'm going to put my little mistakes. I got to take my mistakes home.
You gotta watch the coven, bitch.
You know I'm coming back. I'm gonna watch that. Let me load it up now.
It's already loaded up. I'm ready.
No, okay, bitch, I'm about to load mine up, boo. Oh,
huh?
Fuck, the fucking coven is back.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
All right,
man.
All right, in the show.
My bad, man. I'm reading. NES left me a message. Okay, anyway. All right, y'all. All right. We closing out, man. This was Hot Damn Politics. And I got to say thank you again, Firelines. I know she on snooze control right now. But it was an honor. Thank you so much for letting us go on to the previous chapter. We love
yeah,
you, honey. You're fucking best, man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, see y'all in about, what, 4? Let me see. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 o'clock. 7 hours. All right, baby. That ain't bad. Y'all get the rest. Y'all get to sleep for 7. I'm going to be up, though. Y'all got 7 hours.
Hey,
you better be here, nigga. You better be here early, too. Get Aunt New to wake you up.
Hey, man, I'll be up. Hey, but listen, dog. You know that's the motherfucking reptilian Graves, though. They got his ass trapped down in that thing. I'm out. Peace. I'm real talking.
What? You talking about a guy
who's
in
the trap? No conversation. Yeah. That's why he said the motherfucker came in and he was describing the eyes and shit and how that's
you know
all
what?
He could see.
Stop it. That was in my mind, though, with all these descriptions that was coming in the prison and then the doctors and the lab.
Yeah,
you mean
no fucking human.
I said I'm just going to keep reading. I'm not even going to say, man. It might be some fucking extraterrestrial experiment going on around this motherfucker.
See, the true stranger than fiction. That's what deja vu. That's what all this shit is that everybody be going through. For real.
I don't want to say this shit on the show, but it is some shit that I had a brush of reality in one of those scenes. Like, I deal with this certain times in my life, and I know I only shared it with Tahuti and ISIS. I only shared that it's a scene in this thing that we just read with all the torturing and shit that went on and how the double thinking takes place. But then when O'Brien had to explain to Winston what the fuck it really is and how it's shit, you know, talking about that shit. It's the same shit, how to take out something that did exist and tell him that it never existed or have him even think or your own thoughts are deceiving that maybe this never fucking happened. That has happened to me. And I'm gonna say it right here on this fucking show. So I won't have to say it on my show because everybody's asleep anyway. And hopefully, you know, people won't download this show and listen to what we just said.
We need them to download this show.
No, hopefully they don't. I'm going to put it on record. There are times, and I told this to ISIS and to Tahuti. I said, man, I don't even know if Dr. York fucking is real. I don't even know if I really fucking met him. I don't know if, I swear. Didn't I tell y'all that, ISIS and Tahuti?
Yes.
See? And that was the part. Like, I don't know if I'm deceiving myself. I don't know if this actually, but there is evidence, though. But if these evidence that I have would ever disappear, my nigga, this would definitely would eliminate out of my mind. Mm. I would probably be making the whole goddamn thing up. This is what they were getting him to do. Forget everything.
Absolutely. That's right.
Forget the truth. Forget your existence. Forget your real memories. All of that fucking shit.
Mm. And the thing is, he was so dumb, he thought at first, before they broke him, he was thinking he needed to remember it right. He thought he would just tell the truth. And the truth, they didn't want him to remember the truth or a lie. It didn't matter what the fuck he remembered.
Exactly. Only whatever new shit that they come up with.
Yeah.
I know. That's what I'm talking about, man. That's why I know, man. There's some other shit going on, Babylon. It's some other shit. And I'm going to tell you how I know it's some other shit. Insoc is involved with this whole Nubian shit. The party.
Yeah.
Because you know what? For the past goddamn week, you know what motherfuckers been calling me, asking me about? Something I have no fucking idea that exists.
Okay.
Actual fucking facts. Pop-top-ook shit. And shit like that. And I'm saying, I don't have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. They're like, well, he wrote them, didn't he? And I'm like, no, the fuck he didn't. Well, isn't that the new books? I'm like, no, the fuck it ain't. It ain't what the fuck, you know what I'm saying? So they living in this new Insoc, the party, you know what I'm saying, you know, deletion of something in replace of what we have today, what we have right now, us have, and what they have, thinking that that's the real shit. And I can't even, you can't even convince them different. You can't even tell them that it's not real. That's going to be the new brainwashing fucking information. The brainwash you from right knowledge in Nuwapu, those fucking books. And these bigots and these motherfuckers, I'm telling you, yes, I know. And they changed the language and everything. And I always said that these motherfuckers were the government. COINTELPRO, I always said that I'd be. That they were the government. Okay. I knew that when Dr. York let me see them for who they were. And, of course, you can't say that shit to everybody, though. Because, you know what I'm saying? Because it's kind of like somebody telling you, ISIS, that I'm the government. So if I'm telling somebody that's with them, these motherfuckers, that they're the government, they're not going to fucking, they think I'm fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? But I know that's what they're doing. This is the fucking 1984 right in my goddamn face with this whole shit. With, you know what I'm saying, they got rid of the fucking holy tablets and shit.
Yeah, that's right, done.
Put it down.
Replace them motherfuckers with some old stupid shit. Replace the Right Knowledge series with some shit called something Nuwapu or some old stupid shit.
Potterack, the way.
Yeah, the way. Shit like that. And now these motherfuckers calling asking me I got that shit. And I'm telling them that shit ain't fucking real. They saying bullshit, bitch. This the new shit. This is the new speak. This is the new shit.
Okay, Don, once again, I got to put it on record. I know a person who was there when the niggas that so-called had this. I told you that story. Never mind. I told you about it. The big-ass book story where they had the big-ass book with all the writers so-called. And then they devised those books, those Potteracts. That's why the motherfuckers read like notes, like somebody just took
The same thing with Who Is God. Same thing with that Who Is God. You know that big, the little book about the size of, let's set the record straight. Y'all know the book Isis Tahuti because y'all gave it to me. What's the book? Is that Who Is God?
Is Jesus God.
Yeah, that book is not even written by Dr. York.
At all.
Okay.
No, those are a bunch of notes and shit. And then there's a bunch of copy-paste ISBN numbers in between statements.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that.
Dr. York didn't have a hand in that shit. That's Tron in them.
But that book, I swear, Don, that book, now, I got to say something, though. That book, Is Jesus God? That book right there, regardless of who wrote it, I read it 1,000 times. That book is very truthful.
No, it's not. And some of those are just notes, though. Those are notes that they took from
But I'm talking about the information. Now, but the Potterack shit.
I disagree with it. Well, I know that's not Dr. York. I know his words. I know his formula.
Well, I ain't say Dr. York. I said no matter who wrote it. When I read that book, I got it right here. I don't like it.
It's so many misdirections in that shit. It's incredible. I can see all of the subliminal suggestions in the fucking book. Mm-hmm. It's so many subliminal suggestions. We'll go through it, honey, and I'll show it to you.
Yeah, I mean, duh, you know, no doubt. I mean, I ain't talking about that because
you probably catch it, but I catch everything.
No, Don, remember now.
Catch all the subliminal suggestions. That's in that book.
That's the book. That's the book where they told, where I told you the story of, I refused to buy that book on months of occasions, and when I finally bought that book, it was in Albany, Georgia, and that's the book when I saw the Dengir, and I had an experience. So I know, I mean, I'm with you on that, so we could build on that, on the book.
No, I'm going to tear the book down.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm with you, whatever, however you want to call it. Both of them build it, to me. Because in order to construct, you have to deconstruct. In order to deconstruct, you got to construct.
Oh, yeah, and it certainly will make a great show. Yeah.
But I did get the pot to rock. One second, I did get the pot to rock. I didn't read them. I looked through some of them. I know that's bullshit. I got all of the actual fact bullshit. Looked through some of them. I know that's bullshit.
I know it. That's what 1984, like, we're fucking living it. Like, I know I'm in this shit, like, so fucking, I can see these son of a bitches. I just don't want to end up like Winston.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's why I ain't joining none of them motherfuckers.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't joining. Yep. Winston wanted to join something that got him fucked up. Now he's got his whole memory fucking deleted. Now he on this goddamn Hua Taka Waka shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I even, no. I am old school, baby. I am old school all day.
Yeah. I'm with it, Don, though. I mean, I know, boy, man, you know, they're my biggest fucking enemies right there. So I agree that they fucking insult COINTELPRO and every goddamn thing.
Oh, I already know they. I know they are.
And on that homosexual shit we talked about today. Fucking conference call.
Yeah,
shit.
They all Luciferians. They all part of.
Yeah.
They all with that shit. Like, you know what I'm saying? That's what that shit is. I ain't nowhere in hell. I ain't joining none of them motherfuckers.
That's
I ain't
right.
with none of I ain't trying to belong. I don't want a revolution, motherfucker.
I tell you,
I don't want to come together. Shit.
Yeah.
Ooh. You know what I'm saying? I already know what the fuck's going to happen. It's not, Children be mind fucked. I'm mind fucked. We back sleeping shit.
Yeah. Back sleep. Now, that's the scariest shit in the world.
Hell yeah. That's what happens when you join a motherfucker and you just start listening to they run they fucking mouth. They putting your ass to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
All that shit, that little seven little motherfuckers you be talking about, Babylon on YouTube with the little light bulb in they fucking head.
Yeah.
Like, I ain't fucking with that shit.
That shit is crazy,
man.
I was the motherfuckers down that was on that, on that damn
news, on
news
that news
report
now.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, that's
damn.
What I'm be talking about.
What kind
that
of news
was,
report?
That was a good news report, too, by the way.
Yeah.
I got to watch it again so I can tell you what was good about it, because now I forgot, because I did mention that. That was great.
I saw it. I didn't want to share with you because I didn't know if you liked some shit you wanted to see or not, but yeah, enough motherfuckers circulated it, so I saw that it made its way back to you.
Yeah, Cedar dropped it on my page.
Yeah.
Can I get a copy now?
Shit, I don't even know where that fuck that shit at. Yeah, drop it.
I don't know where it's at,
shit.
But
let his
it's
let his friends see it too. On his friends list.
Yeah,
I don't know where it's at.
Okay, I don't have no.
Oh yeah, it came out like last week and shit. Channel 5 or what's that nigga name? You know that little the white guy that always the fucking investigator and shit. And so, you know what I'm saying, your nigga Basim, Babylon.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? They went to his little...
Why
are
you talking about my nigga? Don't say that, though, Don. My nigga. Nah, that ain't my nigga. That nigga gay. Stop, man. Stop. I can't even let it fly, because hell no.
When I saw the background, I was like, them the people who was bowing and shit. So when I saw the background.
Yeah, and that was the dude that was debating with Unk ass. So that's Basim, right, Babylon?
I don't know. I mean, I ain't never seen
Unk. Yeah, but
wasn't
that Basim debating with Unk? Remember Unk came to Georgia? And we mean you talking about that class, that little tape, not that, that little, they were outside arguing and shit.
See, I thought you were saying by Sim, and you
okay.
saying by Steel.
Yeah, same difference. What's that nigga name?
Basile.
Okay, yeah, well, that was Basile. So they had Basile on the fucking news and shit. And I can't remember the dark-skinned nigga that was there. And they were telling the camera, leave us alone. Go away. Stop bothering us.
Damn.
Yeah, man, it was like an Egyptian-style building has been erected in DeKalb County in Decatur, Georgia.
Right.
From the child molester member leader and shit. And you know what I'm saying? These motherfuckers and some old shit they were saying and shit, you know what I'm saying? How
yeah,
you know, they still working to
like,
get them out and shit.
They're
and
like, why
see,
is his words basically still alive, basically? That's what they're
yeah, and then you see,
was.
You know, but I'm going to tell you the truth, though. The Fed's supposed to shut that shit down. We're dealing with racketeering here, ladies and gentlemen.
Ah.
Do you understand? That's what the news
yeah,
reported last yeah. week. York is charged with child molestation and racketeering. And if,
right.
and if it's racketeering, it's based on organized it's organizations. So,
absolutely.
That shit, you know, the Fed's supposed to shut all that shit down. They said that they're getting communication from York. Now, mind you, York is supposed to be in jail for goddamn racketeering.
Right.
And racketeering is based on child prostitution. It's like...
Yeah.
There should
be
not a fucking store in sight. The Fed's supposed to shut it down.
Right.
Yeah.
All their operations, all his shit.
That's
yeah.
Right.
That's why I said it was a good article. It was a good
right.
it was a good news report. That's what's good about it. I'm able to, you know, but niggas can't see it. Niggas can't see it. If it was
I
good,
want to see it.
If,
yeah.
You know,
that's
what I'm saying. Niggas
thoughts.
Can't see what the fuck they're saying. You know what I'm saying? Because they're so busy believing everything that they're saying, but they can't see the fucking truth even in the fucking lie.
Right.
Because there's
that's
no
right.
way there's supposed to be a store that exists. And then they said Babylon that they admit, they said that he is giving orders from inside ADX prison.
Yeah.
Giving, you know,
yeah, Colorado
you
and shit.
Yeah, nigga
right.
can't do that because he can still be finding prostitution and racketeering.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? He can still do that, right?
That's
yeah, right. That's why.
I know.
I mean, this
so
ain't the first
right
time
here.
This has happened. They cut Yahweh completely off from his communication, and even now that he out, he still can't do that or participate or
absolutely.
Even talk to
absolutely.
Nobody
and mind
about
you, though,
the fucking
but check this, though, Neff. But this nigga so-called still writing goddamn books, though, Neff. This
right.
nigga still so called writing goddamn books and everybody think this nigga in jail. Oh my God, this is retarded. That means that
hey,
the justice system must be real lenient on Dr. York, I tell you.
Yeah, or real raggedy.
Yeah.
One of the two.
No, lenient. You got, they must really like this nigga to keep funding his organization.
Right.
And they
off of what the fuck
I mean,
he charged with.
Yeah, I put my 2 cents of why it's, like why they bringing this shit up. But, yeah, I was just like, damn.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, man, you got these niggas in the parking lot, Babylon, telling the white man, leave.
That's
leave,
funny.
Get
That's
out. Leave us alone. Go away. Mind you, they
you
supposed to be cars and
shit,
don't they?
That's what that's what I'm thinking as you say that. That's
they
what I'm saying.
They goddamn
like,
fools.
Some fucking models.
I would love for them to bring their ass here, but they ain't finna come here, though.
Right.
I would love for the news to come bring their ass right here to All Eyes on Egypt and Monticello. Nigga, it'd be a great day.
That's what one of my thoughts was. I'm like, when are they going to come to Dallas?
They have, though. They have came here, but they, something must have scared them.
They knew better.
something must have scared them, man, because they ran back in their truck and got the hell on. I ain't bullshitting. So I'm upset him. And when Bill Osinski came, that's the nigga that was on Montel, the little white guy now. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
When Bill Osinski came to the goddamn store, he was a reporter for Atlanta Journal Constitution. So they fired him for slandering Dr. York in the paper. Mm. But when he came, you know what I'm saying? He never came back. he didn't even write the article on me or what everything I fucking said. He did not print nothing in the paper.
Nothing. Wow.
Hell nah, nigga. Cause he can't. He tried to.
Yeah.
He tried to print.
Was,
you know what I'm saying? He thought I was stupid.
Uh-huh.
But he couldn't print. He couldn't print it. He had to print it the way I said it. He wanted to print it the way he wanted to lead the audience or the readers to believe. He wanted to use my statements as she believes. Nah, nigga, you ain't gonna put no I believe a goddamn thing. I ain't tell you shit about my belief, motherfucker. So he just said, well, can I please? I said, what you gonna write? What you gonna put? I'm gonna put that you may think. Nah, nigga, that shit ain't gonna work either. Nigga, you better put that this bitch said that this motherfucker ain't in jail, motherfucker.
Right.
Now, mind you, this Bill Osinski, who went on Montel Williams saying that he is in jail. This nigga is not even, this cracker is not even debating with me in my fucking store that Dr. York ain't locked up, Ness.
That's
not even debating with me.
Debate.
And mind you, this nigga been on Dr. York dick harder than any Nawabian on the fucking planet. Just, you know, trying, you know, like digging in these trash cans and shit. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Nigga been digging in this trash can and shit, following this nigga behind trees and shit, trying to get something on this motherfucker, to get some news, some information, some reports. Couldn't do it.
Yeah, I'm like, are they going to stick a camera in Don's face?
Huh?
Those motherfuckers was camping out. I was like, are they going to put a camera in Don's face?
I've seen the people come. I seen them come and they just got right back in their fucking car.
See, that's what I'm saying. They didn't go up to your shit. They went up to their door.
Yeah, but Bill Osinski came in though, Neff. But the news crew ain't fucking. They ain't no better come up in this motherfucker, man. These Masons and them fucking rednecks ain't allowing that shit. You know I'm protected by Mr. White Man, by the four beasts.
That's right.
You know they ain't coming fucking with me. You know I got this. Police department, I got everybody. Them niggas in Decatur ain't got nobody. They have no protection. They even have the CEO of DeKalb County. Do you understand the mayor of this city? Do you understand the mayor of this city's son is in love with my daughter? You know what I'm saying? How deep this shit is. Like, yo, man, watch out now. Nah, but I would love for them to calm down now.
Yeah, I don't think they'll knock on your door though. They won't.
And
they
then
won't
they went on YouTube,
camera.
Babylon. They had YouTube clips and shit of them little them people with the little blue lights and the little bit light bulbs in their head and shit.
Yeah.
Damn. I know them crackers was laughing.
I was like, that's the spot. That's the spot where they be doing that shit.
yeah, that's where they doing that sick ass shit at, man. And they had a lady that you said they couldn't read a word. They're like, Pop-Tok, they showed a clip of her ass, retarded, can't read the shit she's supposed to say, with a little light bulb flashing.
Right.
Clock Howard, Babylon, Clock Howard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you
Clock
know,
Howard, yeah, I like Clock Howard.
Again, do not underestimate his fucking investigations.
Yeah, what you mean do not underestimate? That's why I said this shit was good. And it was some pearls they dropped in that shit too, man, that should pique a few interest. You can't pay for that much advertisement. You know what I'm saying? Now, the store is going to get, you know what I'm saying, some customers and shit out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. But some of the pearls that they fucked around and dropped a few pearls of Dr. York. You know what I'm talking about? They had Dr. York clip playing in that motherfucker. That nigga said profound shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's when he was on the big-ass stage. He was on one of the big-ass stages, too. It was like,
hell yeah. Yeah. They had him on, they had him goddamn dropping the pearls, my nigga. You
He was talking big shit. He was like, can't nobody tell us nothing.
Yeah.
I was like, heck yeah. That was a great clip.
That was a bad clip right there, goddamn. He said, we got the right to do what the fuck we want to goddamn do. Shit, this is all
that's
shit. Damn sure did, man. Oh, I had Seals up there, too, didn't they? They had Seals. What the fuck was Seals talking about now?
They actually interviewed
this
fucking dog.
The shit that Sheriff Seals said, it was fucking way left field. This nigga was talking about Colt and Heaven's Gate and David Koresh and shit.
Yeah, he was like, it all ends bad.
But see, it doesn't matter. There is no Colt no more, remember? You got rid of the Colt leader. So he shouldn't even be mentioning David Koresh and all the rest of them motherfuckers. According to Seals, he arrested the nigga.
Exactly.
That should be the end of that.
Right. See, that's when I knew. I was like, oh, shit, that's like, they know this shit. They like, I said, by this interview.
Girl, Seals is right down the street from me now. Seals was in this fucking town last week on, I think it was a Tuesday. He was here.
Mm.
The Seals is right down the street. Edenton is 15 minutes from us. That's our, like, you know, neighbor in town.
Okay.
Yeah. The so-called sheriff that's supposed to, you know, Sheriff Seals, the one that investigated and got the nigga locked up. We could hear Sheriff Seals got some words to say. Yeah. All he talked about was David Koresh and Heaven's Gate and Colts and shit.
It always is bad. That's what he said. Always
indeed,
is bad.
All those are
he said it
coats,
always
so
is bad as that? If this is going to be the beginning of taking down the Nubian Nation.
Right.
Yeah,
and
that's how
he
sounded
like
he was talking Babylon. You got to hear that shit.
Right.
I do.
You got to see it.
Really
you going to put it on your page.
That's
okay.
How I knew. I was like, these crackers on Nuwapu is here to stay. Period.
Yeah, yeah,
they
that shit ain't going nowhere. Except for them fools.
Ain't going nowhere.
Decatur got to go. They need to take that to San Francisco or some old shit.
Damn.
And take the rest of the fags with them.
That what they
fucking
about for
imprint.
Real.
They implants. They ain't even from Georgia. Mm. Them niggas.
They from New York, right?
Them
niggas is, they northeast. Ain't they from
Philadelphia?
Yeah.
From,
that's right. New York. And Philly.
See, they ain't back up there. They can't do that, though. They mom and dad, they fuck their ass up. They find out they fucking each other. They got to do all this shit down here, thousands of miles away from home, from their mom and their daddy.
Yeah.
You take that back where they come from. But anyway. But yeah, but that was pretty good, though, man. That was a good news report.
I know, man.
I mean,
you
just reported
like, please, go, bye. Get away from us. Get off our party lot.
Well, Kyle would be looking retarded as hell too, man. So I can't wait to see this.
Yeah, you know it, man. Yeah, you should see how fucking Bill Osinski look, man. Like, yo, this motherfucker's shooting bad. Clark, I'm about to be fired though. They fucked around and said not to your name. He ain't about to have a job in a minute. Watch, mark my fucking words.
That's right. That's
he
fucked
around and said his name.
But
he supposed to say his name.
But you know
that they leader.
They used though.
He supposed to say York.
I know you peeped the name.
What?
The White.
I didn't hear the White. I didn't hear them say the White. I was looking for the word the White come out of his mouth.
They used
the
White.
You sure
enough? I noticed that. Yeah. You'll hear it. Play it again. They used the White. And I noticed that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Girl.
The White.
When did y'all watch this?
Huh?
When y'all watch this? Y'all didn't even
it was last week, boo. It was our Thanksgiving treat. The 2 days before Thanksgiving. One of them, I know it was last week, wasn't it, on there?
Yeah, I think it was on Thursday.
Y'all was behind the
on Thanksgiving. That's when I first saw it.
Mm.
It was on my page, my front page now. I mean, Babylon. Whatever the fuck. That shit called.
Yeah, the first person I saw posted was actually India. That's where I got it from.
Oh, okay.
India.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I know that Cedar dropped it on my page. I clicked on and watched that shit and enjoyed that shit. That shit was fucking good, yo.
Right.
Well.
Yeah.
Somebody should call the whistleblower and tell him come on the goddamn Monticello, man, and come do this shit over here. So I can advertise my funders and shit. I take them all around and be like, this is priced at $5,000. This is a one-of-a-kind Isis and Osiris set here and actually had grapes and wine in this chair, motherfucker.
Take them on the tour. Store tour, come on.
Fuck yeah, I give a whole goddamn tour, nigga. Real talk, goddamn.
Right.
Yeah. Shit. I tell them everything. Every fucking thing. They won't put it. I got so much fucking physical evidence, my nigga. I would love to bring it to the cracker man. Because they're the only ones that understand. You can't give it to the Negroes, the Nubians, the Nubians.
That's it,
huh? Yeah, I'll pull out all the shit Dr. York gave me. Boom. Explain that.
Mm.
That's what I say. Explain this. Explain that right there.
Mm. They knew who to go to. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, that's why Wilsinski ain't never came back. I slapped him in the face with that shit Dr. York gave me. That nigga ain't never came back after that. I know who that nigga was, too. I think my daughter or somebody came in. They was like, Mom, it's a white man in the store. I said, man, look, let Doc talk to him. So I heard Doc talking to him and shit. And then he was saying, and this is what Bill Osinski said in Babylon. I heard him say it out loud. He said, do you have any old lectures of Dr. York? Now, mind you, Neff, according to the penitentiary, this nigga been locked up since 02.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, two. Shit. Okay.
Courtesy of Bill Osinski and everybody else, right? Doing all the media and shit. This nigga.
Right.
Now, mind you, this nigga been on Montel. This nigga been on everywhere. The cracker. This nigga's like, no, I'm actually looking for old lectures from Dr. York, old classes, like old. And I heard him kept trying to explain it. Doc's like, what you mean, like old, like what? You know what I'm saying? Like, he said, like, you know, like, old. Like,
yeah.
He was trying to, you know, like, go way back. He wasn't talking about no Tamarate classes and shit. He was like, old. And then some said, man, get your ass up and tell Doc to fucking stick to medicine. Like, this shit ain't going to work. So I got up, my alpha came to the front of the store, man, and goddamn, there it was. Nigga wanted some old lectures. And then, he was like, I'm in debt. That's what Bill said. You know, the cracker always going to confess to me. He said, I'm in debt. He said, this book broke me. He was like, the book, remember that book he came out with?
Something about Dr. York.
He said, this book broke me. He said, I ain't got no money and I want to do a movie. He said, I want to do a movie, but I ain't got no money. The reason why you got no money, motherfucker, because you should have let me help you put out the goddamn book, motherfucker. That's why your book didn't sell, nigga. And then he said, but I got a movie. I said, well, then you need to let me look at the fucking script. Now you want to do a movie on Dr. York and shit, right? I said, well, then you need to let me read the motherfucker, make sure the shit right and exact and it's accurate and put me as one of the fucking the stars of the fucking movie. Like, maybe one of the fucking, I'm the star player. You feel me? And then got there, and then the nigga said, but I ain't got no money. I'm in debt. I said, well, get the money from Montel. He said, Montel said he'd give me another dime. That's what he said. And Cracker said, Montel ain't give me another dime. This nigga was wearing them shoes with the little Velcro lashes on, man. That nigga couldn't even afford shoe strings. And his shoe was running over, man. That nigga was in a boy, I think he was living out his van, that Cracker.
Wow, the Walmart shoes. Velcro.
Yeah, he was what's the word, obsessed with Dr. York, the writer, the journalist. He was, this cracker was obsessed with him.
Mesmerized.
Yep, Bill Osinski, boy. He thought he was going to get paid off of that shit, him and those three witches of New York. Three witches of the rotten apple. Fucking bitches. They thought they was going to get paid off that shit. Them hoes struggling. All of them.
Yeah.
Him and them three bitches. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
the
three bitches that lame nigga wrote Neff about.
Yeah.
Oh, them broads.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Blavatsky, Zegroom, and Austiche.
Okay, for the record, I like Blavatsky. Madam Blavatsky. Don't talk bad about
her.
I like that old witch. I don't know, for some reason I just like her.
Yeah, she was a powerful bitch. She the god of all the shit they got going.
Yeah. She's actually the mystery Harley. What if it comes out to be her the whole goddamn time and not the Queen of England? It comes out to be Madame Blavatsky and shit.
Hey, see, that's what I was talking about. Neff, Revelations 17, 18.
Okay.
Yeah, you pointed that out to Hebrew Israelite today, that the harlot is a nation of people.
Right. Absolutely.
17:18 tell you that. It tell you that all throughout the motherfucker, but that's where it says plainly exactly what you told him.
I'm like, nigga, I know that.
Yeah.
Now, you're so intelligent, man. Now, if you have progressed far enough, it is time that you build your own home. Go off to a faraway place, and there set up your city. And there you would be Queen Nefertiti.
That's right.
To build the structure. The infrastructure. The infrastructure.
Yeah, set the infrastructure up. And we'll, what's the word on Pharaoh, Neff? We'll front you. Front you
okay.
That money.
Right. So I can build. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you go into debt.
Raw materials.
And then we can tell you, you know, so this is our last time bailing you out.
Right. We like that anniversary, nigga. Yeah. No doubt, Don.
I know it. All right, y'all. Let's get up out of here, man. My baby's in the car. They waiting on my all
right.
All my mistakes.
Peace to all eyes on Egypt Academy.
Yeah, man. Peace to the landlord. It's truly wonderful. I said it to Hootie. I love you niggas, man. Y'all niggas need to come back on the show more often.
Right.
Hey, I said
everyone asked for.
I know it. They babies in school, in homeschool, too, so they don't have time for us no more. All right, y'all. We up out of this biatch. See y'all in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Uh-oh, y'all still got 7 hours. Peace.
Hardly acting naughty. I said, Shawty, would you call me? She said, pardon me, all you want. WGHE Radio presents Hot Damn Politics.